the Senate Education Committee to order. Thank you for making an effort to be here on time, because we've got a full agenda and a full room, as you can see. And I'd like to begin. One of the subjects that's on our agenda is dealing with some of the streams of revenue, one of which is the integration revenue. And the legislative auditor, I believe in 2005, did a study on integration revenue, and is here to give us a review of that report, because I believe that it is still appropriate for background for us as we deliberate on this issue. So welcome, Mr. Nobles. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me is Judy Randall, who was the manager of our evaluation of school district integration revenue. And Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for holding this hearing and inviting us to attend. This is a report that we issued in 2005, and it was critical in many respects of this program, both for the distribution of the money, who gets it, who doesn't. And we also call for clarification of what districts are supposed to be doing with this money, because some get it and some don't. And we think that because it is a categorical aid, that you, the legislature, had something in mind when you wanted to give this special revenue to some districts and not others. And when we went out to evaluate the program, we found that that purpose was still quite ambiguous. So we call for some clarification, call for a number of other reforms and changes, and frankly, it's been rather difficult for the legislature to adopt those. And so we appreciate you keeping this report and these issues alive, and we are here to present our findings and recommendations to you, and I'd like to turn to Ms. Randall to do that. And again, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm an evaluation coordinator with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And we're happy to be here today, as Mr. Noble said, to talk with you about our evaluation on school district integration revenue. As you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nobles noted, this is an evaluation we released in 2005. So I just want to put out a caveat there that some of the numbers in this presentation have been updated, others have not, but the general point still stands. So I'll point out cases where the numbers are still old. But again, our findings and recommendations still 6 years later now still stand. So let me kind of cut to the chase. Our bottom line on this was that the program needs more focus and oversight. Specifically, we found that the purpose of the program is not clear. There were a lot of questions out there when we spoke to people about what this program is about. Is it about racial integration? Is it about academic achievement? Is it about racial tolerance? As we did our evaluation, it became more and more clear to us that the purpose of the program was not clear. And then following pretty much directly from that, the districts used the revenue in a variety of ways. And then we also found that the funding formula that the legislature has in place for the program has some unintended consequences. Those are kind of the big findings and where I'll be headed today. But before I do that, let me take a step back, talk a little bit about what this program is about, and provide a little more context for those findings. So first, here's a place where the numbers have been updated. In fiscal year 2011, 125 school districts were eligible for integration revenue and received $91 million in integration revenue. That's a split between aid and levy funding, about $64 million in state aid and about $27 million in local levy. Now, school districts can either be identified as eligible for the program or they can voluntarily participate. And there are three ways that districts are identified as eligible. The first is based on intra-district demographics, and this is when a school district has what's called a racially identifiable school. And that is when the protected student population in one school in the district is 20 percentage points or higher than the protected student population enrollment in the district as a whole. In that case, the school district is identified as being eligible for integration revenue and would participate or would receive funding. A district can also be identified as eligible if it is a racially isolated school district. This is now kind of an inter-district relative measure where the protected student population of the isolated school district is 20 percentage points or higher more than a neighboring or adjoining district. And in that case, both the racially isolated district and the adjoining district are eligible for integration revenue. And then finally, school districts can voluntarily choose to work with an isolated district and thereby also become eligible for integration revenue. It's kind of complicated, and words don't always do it justice, so we have this map. Now, this is old numbers, but again, the point still stands. Here in 2005, this shows St. Paul there in red. In 2005, St. Paul had 72% of its enrollment were protected students. This was more than 20 percentage points higher than the protected student enrollment of its neighboring or adjoining districts there in yellow. So you can see Roseville, North St. Paul, South Washington County, South St. Paul, and West St. Paul. So they're in the yellow. So they're the adjoining districts. They and the isolated district of St. Paul all receive integration revenue. Now, taking this to the next step there in pink or purple, not sure how it shows up there, you can see the voluntary districts. They, too, have chosen to participate with St. Paul, the isolated district, in its integration revenue program, and thereby they, too, are eligible to receive integration revenue. So there you see White Bear Lake and Matamidi and Stillwater and Invergrove Heights, who, although not neighboring to St. Paul, have, again, chosen to work with the school district. Not on the slideshow, but perhaps in the handout, is a map, again, based on 2005, that shows where school districts that are eligible for the program are clustered. They're generally clustered around the Twin Cities metropolitan area and southwestern Minnesota, although it's starting to scatter Duluth, Rochester, et cetera. So that's a pretty quick overview, I know, of the program and who's eligible to participate. Let me go now back to our main findings, the first of which was that there are lots of different ideas about the purpose of this program, and the purpose of the program is not clear. As part of our evaluation, we met with 20 different school districts that were participating in the program and heard, frankly, more than 20 different ideas about what the program is about. So I'm going to share some of them with you here. They're not easy to read, and kind of part of the point is that there are so many of them, it kind of more than fills up the screen here, but I'll read some of them aloud. So some folks said this was about increasing parent involvement, providing staff development, offering all-day kindergarten, achieving student success, integrating the community. You can see the list goes on and on and on, down to reducing class size. Bottom line, really, is that there's not a clear picture of what this program is about. We took all the different ideas we heard from folks involved in the program and categorized them into six broad categories: to achieve racial balance and integration, to address the achievement gap, to provide staff development, to increase multicultural awareness, to increase community involvement in the schools, and to increase interracial contact. So you can see, taken together, these six categories are really pretty broad, and frankly, a school district can justify pretty much any type of spending under these six categories. Not surprisingly, then, this led us to our next finding, which is that districts use the money in a variety of ways, largely reflecting their interpretation of what the program is about, and to some extent also reflecting the individual needs of the school district. So, for example, in the Twin Cities area, we saw many instances of inter-district magnet schools, where school districts in these integration revenue collaboratives would work together, provide magnet schools that students in any of the districts participating in the collaborative could attend. Also in the Twin Cities, we saw some classroom partnerships. So, for example, a St. Paul classroom and a Stillwater classroom might pair up, get together on a monthly or somewhat regular basis, working on projects together. I think the idea behind the classroom partnerships and the inter-district magnet schools was to develop kind of an ongoing, sustaining relationship between students that attend school in different school districts. In outstate Minnesota, it's harder to do things during the traditional school day or school week, so we saw summer academic camps or summer soccer camps, again, finding ways to bring students from different districts and different backgrounds together in a meaningful way. We also saw a number of school districts that had, kind of one-day multicultural festivals. We did see some what we tagged as questionable uses of integration revenue, including purchasing U.S. history textbooks and providing ELL services. Certainly, those are good things for a school to provide, but the reason why we thought those were questionable is, as Mr. Noble said, not all school districts are receiving integration revenue. So because only some school districts are receiving integration revenue, it needs to be used for a certain type of purpose. All school districts need to purchase textbooks. All school districts need to provide ELL services. So we didn't see that as something unique to schools participating in integration revenue programs. The next big finding was that the funding distribution had some unintended consequences. Two points under this larger finding. One is that the funding doesn't reflect districts' different needs under the program. And secondly, that it resulted in some limited oversight of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and voluntary districts. The 2009 legislature did address many of the concerns with the second bullet, so I will focus more on the first one. But the first thing to understanding that is to understand how integration revenue is funded. I know it's kind of a complicated slide, so I'll walk everyone through it. First, look to the left on the row labels there. You'll see Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth are set aside separately because the amounts they receive are established in statute. Then after that, it depends on the responsibility of the school district. So an isolated school district, one of those red ones like St. Paul was on the map, an adjoining school district, one of those yellow ones on the map, a district with a racially identifiable school, or a voluntary district. So the first thing is to identify the responsibility of the school district within the integration revenue program. Then you go and look at the percentage of protected student enrollment in that school district. If it's less than or equal to 15%, they receive $92 per pupil. If it's more than 15%, they receive $129 per pupil, except if it's a voluntary district, in which case it's just $92 per pupil. So it's pretty complicated. So mostly it's $92 or $129 per pupil, unless you're Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Duluth. The important thing, though, here, in addition to the funding rate, is understanding that the amount of integration revenue allocated is based on the total student enrollment. So what rate you have depends on your percentage of protected student enrollment, but the total amount of money you receive depends on your total student enrollment. So on this slide, it just, for select districts, again, these are 2005 numbers, so these are older numbers, shows the amount of integration revenue different school districts receive. So you can see St. Paul received more than $20 million in 2005 for integration revenue, down to Round Lake, which was an adjoining district that received $12,000 in integration revenue. Again, it's largely a reflection of the total student enrollment in the school district. I think some interesting ones to point out on this slide, Mountain Lake is a small school district in south central or west central Minnesota. Small district, it's a racially isolated district. It received $54,000 in integration revenue. Eden Prairie, at least in 2005, was a voluntary school district, a much larger school district, received more than $1 million in integration revenue. So some real differences in funding levels, largely a reflection of the fact that the amount of funding is based on total student enrollment. Taking this a step further, we found that the formula, we thought, doesn't reflect districts' different needs. And to illustrate this, we used Stillwater and Brooklyn Center. Stillwater here is in yellow, and in 2005, 5% of its student enrollment were protected students. And Brooklyn Center, there in the red, was a racially isolated school district with 66% of its students protected students. Now, again, because the funding rate is applied to total student enrollment, you can see Stillwater received almost $1 million in integration revenue, while Brooklyn Center received $250,000 in integration revenue. And if you look at it on a per protected student basis, you can see Stillwater received more than $2,200 per protected student, compared with Brooklyn Center that received $223 per protected student. So our thought on that is that we don't think that it reflects the district's different needs under this program, but really, before we can really determine that, we have to figure out what the program is about and what we're trying to achieve, and then the funding formula would follow from that. This next one is about the limited oversight of the revenue. I'll just touch on this real quickly because, again, the 2009 legislature addressed many of these issues. When we did the evaluation in 2005, the Department of Education approved the budgets and plans for all school districts except Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, who, because they were kind of identified separately in statute, just received the integration revenue at the time. That law was changed in 2009, so now those three districts do submit an integration revenue plan to the Department of Education. At the time, also, voluntary districts could kind of choose to participate. Working with a racially isolated district did not need additional oversight from the Department of Education, and that too was changed in 2009. So let me just real quickly sum up our main findings, which is that the purpose of the program is not clear. Districts use the money in a variety of ways, again, largely because of what they interpret the purpose of the program to be. And then finally, the funding formula has some unintended consequences. So our recommendations follow pretty directly from those. The first is that the legislature clarify the purpose of the program. you know, is this about the achievement gap? Is it about the racial balance? Is it about racial tolerance? The folks that we spoke with that were administering these programs in their districts wanted clarity from the legislature. They were clear about that to us when we went out and spoke with them. We also recommend that the legislature consider changing the funding formula. In the full report, we outline a couple of different options, perhaps changing the funding rate based on the responsibility of the district. So an isolated school district might receive a more different amount than an adjoining district, perhaps tying the funding to the populations it's intended to serve. And then our final recommendation, again, the legislature largely addressed in 2009, which was regarding the oversight gaps. So, Madam Chair, that was a pretty quick go-through on our evaluation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Randall. Are there any questions that you have of Ms. Randall or the Legislative Auditor's Office, Senator Bonnell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Randall, hello. I'm wondering if you have had a chance to read the recent report of the task force that took this challenge on and has, you know, since issued a report with some findings. I have a couple questions, but that was the first one.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff. I have not had a chance to read it. I did hear a presentation by a gentleman who I believe is here today, too, and it sounded like they, too, recommended clarifying the purpose of the program as kind of the place to start.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Ms. Randall, one of the things that they recommended, which was, you know, we had this task force which began, and we didn't really conclude our work last year, but one of the things they started with in their recommendation was to go at the DSEG rule and to actually to amend the rule so that the rule clarified that there must be nothing that happens that promotes segregation, but then repeals the rest of the DSEG rule. In your opinion, would that be something that would be allowable?
Ms. Randall, or Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think I'd have to look at it more closely before I'd feel comfortable answering that.
Okay.
So, Senator Bonoff, were you asking whether it would be legal to repeal part of the rule? I think we do. I think the legislature does have authority to do that.
Well, certainly, Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, on that question of the jurisdiction of the legislature to intervene and change or repeal an administrative rule, absolutely. You can do that by law on any rule.
Madam Chair,
Senator Bonoff.
I'm sure we'll have a robust discussion, but I think that that's really where the discussion ought to begin, because I think so much of this is in response to what happened with regard to the DSEG rule, and that, you know, perhaps if we had a different rule, we might look at our strategy differently.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. Senator Nino?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just, you know, in looking through the OLA report, I mean, it seems like quite an indictment, actually. I mean, I look at this. The purpose is not clear. Some of the expenditures are questionable. Neither the state nor the districts have adequately assessed results. Racial concentration has increased in some of the school districts. Some unintended and potentially negative consequences. The only positive comment I can find is that many of the expenditures are reasonable. And then there's other comments in here that we don't even know what we're getting, and we're spending about $100 million. I don't know. Thank you for the presentation, but I read this, and can you comment to my observations here?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator members, I would even qualify the positive statement because, yes, they may be reasonable in the greater sense of their for education. But, again, I would go back to the fact that you designed this program in such a way that it was, I think, supposed to have some particular purpose that did not cover all districts, and that's why the formula is designed in the way it is. And as you saw in Ms. Randall's presentation, not all districts get the money. And so I think even though we could find things that it was reasonable in St. Paul to spend the money on, you might well ask, wouldn't it also be reasonable for War Road to have that money and be able to spend it for that purpose as well? And yet they don't. And so, again, we keep coming back to the basic fundamental policy question. If this money is just for some districts and not others, what specifically is it for? that is unique to those districts. That's the fundamental problem that we identified and that we presented to you in this report. And frankly, that's the most difficult thing, I think, for the legislature to grapple with, because it's a question of who gets it, who doesn't, where do we go from here? Because where we go from here may involve some people losing some money.
Thank you very much. I'm going to cut off the discussion there. I think we have Catherine Gersten has some research findings to present. And then we will get to the bill. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Catherine Kirsten. I'm a senior fellow at Center of the American Experiment. And I'm here today to talk about the racial and ethnic achievement gap and about the effectiveness of various ways of addressing it. The problem, we all know, is national in scope and is particularly severe here in Minnesota. In fact, our racial and ethnic gap is among the worst in the country. Our fourth grade reading gap on the National Assessment for Educational Progress is the worst of any state in the nation, only excepting Washington, D.C. I think we all agree that boosting minority academic achievement and narrowing the gap must be one of our state's top priorities. Now, Minnesota has tried to address the racial gap in two basic ways. First, we've tried to create integrated school environments. Historically, this has been done by busing for racial balance, as was done in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And more recently, we've tried through efforts under the voluntary integration rule and related integration revenue. The second way we've tried to reduce the gap is through compensatory funding for low-income students and schools with a large concentration of these students. Today, though, I'd like to take a step back and talk about the theory behind what we call integration, that is, the claim that racially balanced schools are an important and a necessary component of efforts to narrow the gap. The accuracy of this theory is often taken for granted, but there really is little data to support it. I'd like to talk, too, about the related claim that we can expect racially balanced schools to inevitably produce social benefits, like improved race relations, improved college attendance on the part of Black and Hispanic students. And there is also little evidence to support this claim. In fact, the data both here and nationally suggest that if we focus our efforts to narrow the gap on racially balancing our schools, we're likely to be disappointed. Policymakers, I think, should be aware of these data as they decide how best to spend limited taxpayer dollars, and they may want to consider other non-race-related approaches that may be more effective in achieving our goal. The hope that racially balanced schools would boost minority academic performance and narrow the gap dates from Brown v. Board of Education back in 1954. And this hope was tested across America in the most dramatic way possible through a massive and a hugely expensive experiment between 1970 and 1995 or so. During that time, millions of students in urban areas across the country were assigned to schools on the basis of race, and they were bused from their own neighborhoods to achieve racially balanced schools. This happened from Boston to Cleveland to Kansas City, San Francisco, Seattle. But unfortunately, this tremendous effort did little or nothing to significantly improve minority academic performance or reduce the gap. Now, what happened in Minneapolis, I think, was typical. Minneapolis began busing under court order in about 1972. And for almost a quarter century, thousands of Black and white students were bused to achieve racially balanced schools. But by 1995, 23 years later, Minneapolis Black students were not doing significantly better on standardized tests than they had been when busing started. And in fact, in the early 1990s, their scores, on average, actually dropped. In 1995, I interviewed Bill Brown, who was head of the Minneapolis Public Schools Office of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment. He told me that his office had found that academic progress of Black students in Minneapolis was only weakly related to the racial composition of the schools that they attended. And he said that in some cases, Black students in schools with high minority concentrations had made relatively large gains, while Black students in predominantly white schools had made relatively small gains. In 1995, Minneapolis Mayor Sharon Sales Belton called for an end to busing for racial balance, and she joined black mayors across the country, Denver, Cleveland, Seattle, in her campaign to stop assigning kids on the basis of race and return to neighborhood schools with choice options. Like these mayors, Sales Belton emphasized that busing had not lived up to its promise, and she lamented the huge sums that had been spent on transportation. She said kids had been bused to the moon and back, and she said the practice had fractured neighborhoods and made it much more difficult for parents to become involved in their kids' schools. Results of busing were equally disappointing in St. Paul. And the story was similar around the country. And in what follows, I'd like to draw from data discussed in a brief that was filed in the 2007 U.S. Supreme Court case of Meredith v. Jefferson County Board of Education. This has to do with the Louisville schools. And in that case, the court ruled that assigning students to public schools on the basis of race with the sole purpose of achieving racial integration is unconstitutional. The brief, which was written in support of the position that the court adopted, was submitted by three experts on integration: David Armour, Abigail Thernstrom, and Stephen Thernstrom. And Armour is a professor of public policy at George Mason University, and he's been an expert witness in more than 40 school desegregation and educational adequacy cases. Abigail Thernstrom has been vice chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and she's the author of No Excuses, Closing the Racial Gap in Learning. Stephen Thernstrom is a professor at Harvard and an expert on the Voting Rights Act. Now, their brief begins by pointing out that a lot of desegregation research has significant methodological problems. A good deal of it consists of non-experimental observational studies. And when desegregation is under discussion, we often hear the phrase, numerous studies show, while learning nothing about the quality of the research that underlies that claim. Now, I'll quote from Armour and Thernstrom's conclusions about the relationship between racially balanced schools and majority academic achievement. Quote, a comprehensive view of the literature reveals that there is no evidence of a clear and consistent relationship between desegregation and academic achievement. When averaged over large numbers of studies, the effects are generally weak or non-existent. Close quote. Armour and the Thernstroms discussed data from many school districts that have adopted plans for racially balanced schools, including Pasadena, California, and Norfolk, Virginia. Now, both of these districts saw no improvement in minority achievement after comprehensive racial balance plans were adopted. In Dallas, black gains did occur, but they were as great for black students in predominantly minority schools as they were for black students in predominantly white schools. Kansas City, Missouri, of course, had the most expensive racial balance plan ever ordered by a court, costing well over $1 billion. But minority achievement and the gap remained flat. Now, the brief gives particular attention to Wilmington, Delaware, and to Charlotte-Mecklenburg, North Carolina. Both of these districts had countywide desegregation plans with highly racially balanced schools, suburban and urban schools. But though the conditions in each of these districts were ideal, with minority students exposed to middle-class white school environments for many years, the achievement gap remained flat. And I'll quote from the brief. Thus, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, often described as the best example of desegregation in the nation, shows no net reduction in the achievement gap over a 15-year period. Close quote. Now, Armour and the Thernstroms also look at the effect of racial and ethnic balance on Hispanic achievement, which has been studied much less than black achievement. One of the largest studies here was a comprehensive evaluation of a desegregation plan in Riverside, California, by Gerard and Miller, and this was done in 1975. They conclude that, quote, Hispanic students showed no overall benefit. A study by Armour, which he did using 2003 NAEP data, found no relationship between Hispanic concentration and Hispanic achievement. And he also observed this in both California and Texas, which have the largest number of Hispanic students in predominantly Hispanic schools. Now I'll touch briefly on the issue of the effect of socioeconomic balance in schools. This is a different, but of course, a related matter. We can look at both at a voluntary program here, The Choice is Yours, and a mandatory program in Wake County, North Carolina. Under the Choice Is Yours, which has been in place since about 2001, low-income students from Minneapolis can choose to be bused to suburban schools. And in 2004 and 5, Minneapolis students who did choose to be bused to suburban schools outperformed district students. But the following 2 years, the most recent data I've been able to find, low-income students in Minneapolis performed better than students who had been bused to suburban schools. And the difference, researchers speculate, may result from the fact that suburban choice students tested each year are not the same students. Only half of the suburban choice students were enrolled in their suburban schools the previous year. In Wake County, North Carolina, schools there have had the largest income-based and mandatory busing program in the nation. There are very few of these, but they've done it for 10 years. They have highly integrated schools, although the school board there has recently decided to return to neighborhood schools. And a major reason is that after 10 years, there is no significant difference between black students' reading and math scores in highly integrated Wake County schools and those in nearby Charlotte-Mecklenburg, which stopped busing in the late 1990s, and returned to neighborhood schools that have a substantial racial and economic imbalance. And now I'll move to claims about the social benefits of racial balance in the schools. We often hear two kinds of claims. The first is that minority students in racially balanced schools have better long-term outcomes in terms of college attendance and occupational status. And the second is that attendance at racially balanced schools improves social attitudes, decreasing racial prejudice and interracial conflict, and so on. The Armour-Thernstrom Supreme Court brief summarizes the research on both these points. And I'll quote first from their conclusion about long-term outcomes of minority students at racially balanced schools. They say, quote, "There is no evidence of a clear and consistent relationship between desegregation and such long-term outcomes as college attendance, occupational status, and wages." Armour and the Thernstroms note that there is a statistically significant relationship for black students between attending a racially balanced high school and attending a predominantly white college. But they point out that the causal factor here appears to be self-selection, that is, black families' preference for integrated environments generally, rather than the racial composition of the high school attended. The brief also discusses a large study of Project Concern, which was a long-running desegregation program involving voluntary transfers of black students from Hartford, Connecticut schools to desegregated suburban schools. Project Concern students were compared to a control group of students who remained in the predominantly black Hartford schools. The study found no difference in college attendance between Project Concern students and the Hartford control group. Then the brief examines a major study by Boozer, Kruger, and Wolken that used data from the National Survey of Black Americans to estimate the relationship between the percentage of black students in a high school and the total years of education that those students attained. And after controlling for self-selection, the study found the relationship was not statistically significant. Armour and the Thernstroms also look at claims that racially balanced schools lead to greater racial tolerance and similar benefits. There is, they say, quote, "no evidence of a clear and consistent relationship between the racial balance in K-12 schools and racial attitudes, prejudice, race relations, and interracial conflict." Indeed, they say, among the better designed studies, more show negative effects on white attitudes than positive effects. The authors begin by pointing out that many studies in this area have methodological problems, such as lack of standardized measures of social impacts, for example, racial tolerance. And then they discuss major reviews by St. John and Stephan. Stephan, writing in 1986, looked at studies that compared the prejudicial attitudes of students in segregated versus desegregated schools. For blacks, he found that desegregation worsened anti-white prejudice in 4 studies and decreased it in 8 studies and had no or mixed effects in 8 studies. For whites, prejudice grew in 11 studies, got better in 4, and had no or mixed effects in 9 studies. In other words, Stephan found that positive studies outnumbered negative studies for black students, but he found the reverse was true for white students, that desegregated schools increased white racial prejudice. Armour and the Thernstroms discussed two other important studies that looked at social outcomes in racially balanced schools. And one I already mentioned, that's the Gerard and Miller study of desegregation in Riverside, California. It tracked friendship measures for 6 years, and it's one of the few studies, as I said, that includes Hispanics. It found that the number of Black and Hispanic students chosen as friends by white students decreased over time. The other study was by Patchen, who looked at the relationship between racial attitudes and the Black percentage in classrooms in Indianapolis. Patchen found that both Black and white students had the most positive attitudes towards the opposite race in classrooms that averaged more than 70% Black, and the most negative attitudes in integrated classes averaging between 20 and 40% Black. And he concluded that the ideally integrated classrooms, that is, those between 20 and 40% Black, had the highest levels of friction, in part, he thought, due to academic competition. There have been just a few new studies since Patchen's in 1982. There was a review by Schofield in 1995, which concludes, quote, "The evidence on the impact of desegregation on intergroup relations is generally held to be inconclusive and inconsistent." I'll mention one more study before I close, and that is a more recent study by Pettigrew and Tropp, which was the first meta-analysis that showed a positive benefit of interracial contact. It was found to improve racial tolerance by about 0.2 standard deviations. The study's major limitation, according to Armour, is that the authors don't break out interracial contact for K-12 schools, and in particular for those where there's been mandatory desegregation, where some other studies have found worsening relations. So here's my conclusion. In light of this substantial body of research, people who propose that we should attempt to address Minnesota's achievement gap by focusing our time and our effort and our resources on racially balancing our schools after 40 years and many millions of dollars spent unsuccessfully trying to close the gap as a result of these policies, these people, I think, bear a heavy burden of proof. A better approach, I think, would be to look beyond this idea and to ask, without preconditions, how can we use our resources to provide the best possible opportunity for poor and minority children to learn? I think we have to acknowledge that the racial gap is going to be very difficult to eliminate. It's essentially never been eliminated on a broad scale, to my knowledge. However, there are some encouraging models that we can look to. Recently, I know that this committee heard testimony from people from the Florida Foundation for Excellence in Education. And Florida is beginning to narrow its racial and ethnic achievement gap as a result of 10 years of innovative education reforms. And these have included grading schools and curbing social promotion, tying rewards to student performance, adopting alternative certification for teachers. Beyond this kind of statewide education reform effort, we can look to lessons from high-achieving schools with minority student populations, charters like the famous Harlem Success Academy and the Kipp schools, for example. In these schools, success is tied to high expectations, structure, discipline, a content-rich curriculum, innovative instructional techniques, and extended school day or year. I would recommend that Minnesota consider implementing reforms like these on the broadest scale possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kirsten. Are there any questions? Senator Hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering if Ms. Kirsten, you'd be willing to provide your testimony to members of the committee, if that's possible. Not necessarily right at the moment, but if you could make that available, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair and Senator, certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kirsten. Let's move on to the bill. So, Senator Brown, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. I had, Madam Chair, I just had a question for Ms. Kirsten.
Certainly.
Thank you. Ms. Kirsten, I'm curious about the statement you make with respect to how Minnesota has adopted integration and compensatory revenue as revenues for achievement gap. And I'm looking into what the actual legislation says, and we have that really the rule in integration bans intentional segregation and provides procedures for determining whether it has taken place and how it should be remedied. For racially isolated districts and racially identifiable schools that are not the result of intentional segregation. And the rule requires the schools and communities to work together to design and implement educationally justifiable, effective, voluntary strategies that provide meaningful choices of integrated learning. That's the integration. There is no language in this rule that actually specifically asks the state of Minnesota
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
So this is the integration rule. And let me read to you the compensatory education. It says the basic skills revenue under Section 126 must be reserved and used to meet the educational needs of pupils who enroll underprepared to learn and whose progress towards meeting state and local content or performance standards is below the level that is appropriate for learners at their age. To my knowledge, the state of Minnesota does not have policy in place that specifically funds or states any kind of guidance to deal with achievement gap. So integration funding and this basic compensatory revenue funding has very specific goals and are stated as I just read them to you. So why do you say that Minnesota has used these and failed? I'm just curious about your definition of policy and revenue to deal with achievement gap.
Madam Chair and Senator, thanks for the question. I think all of us hope very much that the kinds of funds that we spend, both when it comes to integration and to compensatory revenue, will have two effects. We all want to see minority student achievements improve, and we all want to see the kinds of social benefits that have been looked for through these kinds of policies and this kind of extra revenue across the country for many years. I think we just heard testimony that the purpose of the rule and the purpose of the integration revenue connected with it are in fact unclear. There's many different attitudes and opinions as to what the legislature has been trying to do with these funds and with the programs related to it. So I agree. I would very much like to see additional attention given and additional, repurposing at the very least of funding that will focus on improving minority academic achievement and on closing the gap.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Three.
Thank you, Ms. Kirsten. But again, my question, I agree with you. This is exactly what we're here. All of these people are here to hear that. How are we going to do that? But would you agree that we actually don't have a policy in place in our books right now that directs the districts to do so? Integration policy is not that. We might want it to be, but to say that the state of Minnesota put integration funding in place to deal with achievement gap and that the districts failed to do so, I don't believe is accurate.
Madam Chair and Senator, my point is that this has been the expectation and the hope of these programs and these funds. Whether the language in the statute or in rule makes this clear, this is certainly what Minnesota teachers and parents are looking for. Otherwise, there's absolutely no point to these kinds of efforts and this kind of funding. The compensatory revenue, of course, is focused on low-income students who overlap very significantly with minority students. So there's been I would certainly not say that no efforts have been made to boost academic achievement and to reduce the learning gap on the part of minority students. And these, I think, the average parent or teacher would say, are the policies that we have in place here in Minnesota that have that as a purpose, as a reason to exist.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible, Madam Chair, to, after this testimony, to hear from the department? I think a key element would be if we had these plans in place, it was, I think, in this in the role of the department to review these plans and to see how they fit the, you know, the purpose of that, or how the district's plans fit into achieving their goals.
I think I heard Ms. Randall say that the plans were required of the cities of the first class. I didn't hear that they were required of all districts, or did I miss that? Ms. Randall?
Madam Chair, members, they're required by all districts. What was added in 2009 is the requirement from the first cities of the first class. So it's all districts now are required to submit a plan.
So, Senator Stumpf, what you're asking is what has the department done in terms of the review of that? I'm not sure if we could put them on the spot at this moment. I see Mr. Shackleton saying, acknowledging thanks to that point, but I think that we should ask for that kind of information to come back. Whether we can get it right now, I don't know.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Senator Dave Brown, District 16, and I'm here today to introduce Senate File 422. The goal of this legislation is to prioritize basic revenue funding, minimize the differences in total per-student general education funding statewide, and provides direction for future funding increases. Specifically, areas that it addresses is integration revenue. Currently, in statute, Minneapolis School District receives $480 per student for integration. St. Paul receives $445 per student, and Duluth receives $206 per student. This legislation would propose that they would be eligible to receive what all the other districts, the maximum all the other districts in the state would receive, which would be $129 per student, which would be a reduction for these three districts. It also looks into the area of compensatory, secondary sparsity, elementary sparsity revenue, and transportation sparsity revenue. And it proposes that we, in essence, delink these, meaning that they would not continue to receive automatic increases, but would be capped at the current basic revenue of $5,124. And in the future, if districts needed increases in these areas, they would come to the legislature and ask for the increases, very much like we do for a fund transfer. And then also, it would direct policy towards additional state aid. In the future, if the legislature increased money for general revenue, it would direct that 90% of that revenue be put towards basic revenue funding. The goal of this legislation is to bring about equity in statewide funding of our school districts. Madam Chair and members, this is the basic overview of Senate File 422.
Are there any questions that you have right now? I know we have a number of testifiers, as you can see, and I'm going to ask the testifiers if they would please attempt to limit their comments to about 2 minutes each, or we will not get through this. So if you could be as succinct as possible, I think that will be helpful. I saw a hand here. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Brown, I'm not sure if you're the person to answer this, but you could probably direct the correct testifier up here if you're not. I just have two basic questions. One is, why were those numbers so high in the first place for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth? I mean, is there any rationale why they're, you know, two to three times higher than $129?
Senator Nelson, I think Mr. Nauman can answer that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Nelson, the answer to that question is, like many things in K-12 finance, a residual of history. Years ago, when the integration formula was first created, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth were the only recipients of the revenue. And we burned into law a specific revenue amount. And so it would have been a rather large number. It wasn't expressed as an amount per pupil. Then subsequent to that, I think it was in the 99, maybe even 2000 time frame, this committee, because it was a Senate initiative, converted the overall revenue amount into an amount per pupil. And that was the result. So that's why you end up with a bit of an unusual allowance. It's not an even number, for example. And that was because at that time is what we took the revenue amount in statute and divided it out by the pupils at that time. And that then it just got carried forward. The subsequent revenue amounts of 129 and 92 were added after that point.
So Madam Chair, just a follow-up question. Is there any reason then today for that would justify these differences?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we need to put Mr. Hellman on the spot for that.
All right.
I think that will be our decision. Would you?
Thank you.
Okay. All right.
We do have an answer for the question of for the department making a statement. I believe Ms. Hermanson is here and is prepared to answer what has not been done in terms of the review of the integration plans. Welcome, Assistant Commissioner Hermanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I'm going to admit to being a little unprepared because I was here on another issue. Members of the committee, you made changes in the law in 2009, and at that time you asked the department to review budgets, and I'm speaking a little bit unprepared here. And there are two provisions in statute, as I understand, for the use of the dollars. One is the multicultural integration of, and activities around that for students and closing of the achievement gap. In the law, there's a provision by March 15th, which is next week, districts must submit to the department their proposed budget for the use of integration funding. And those then are reviewed by the department approved by the department, and so we are in the process of looking at the proposals by each of the school districts with dollars and how they intend to use the dollars in the coming year. And again, I'm predicating this on some changes that happened within the last 2 years. There was a recent report, and I don't have this with me, but it is on the website, and we can share it with you on the uses of integration funding. And it's quite varied across the state. The decision as to how they feed into those two goals has to be made in some cases based on the uniqueness of the individual school districts who are using the dollars. And I'd be happy to get more information to you, and we can get you that report. I think the legislative auditor had done a report, and I know they had communications with our department asking what had happened since that report was issued and how we were tracking the changes that were requested in that report. And we do have people in the department who could give you more information on that.
Thank you very much. I don't know if there are any questions, but I think you've given us a fair representation of what, for as long as you've been on the job here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't think we should put you on the spot any more
than
that.
But we're more than happy to give you more detail. But this March 15th deadline will be quite instructive to us as to how districts intend to use their dollars.
Great. Thank you very much. So we have some testifiers. Is this Teresa Graham?
Yes.
Okay. I know you've given us some printed materials.
Yes.
And so I hope you can keep your testimony fairly concise, because as you can see, we've got a lot of interest here.
I certainly will, Senator Olson. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Since my credentials were omitted from the agenda, my name is Teresa Graham. I'm a resident of Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker. I'm also licensed as a school social worker for the past 30 years by the Minnesota Department of Education. So I have a long history of working in schools, nonprofits, and in the private and public sector. In front of you, and I have mailed this to you previously, is the most recent written report that I did. You will not find any other report by the Department of Education or anybody else in this sort of detail. It doesn't exist. I went through all 133 school districts that currently receive this $100 million and summarized according to what they had written, what they are using this money for. There are very specific protocols, according to statute, that they are supposed to be using the money for. The reality is much of the money is not being used for the intended purpose as stated in the statute, as vague as it is. The 2005 Legislative Auditor's Report did a sampling of school districts. I gave a report based on every single school district for this year and next year, what they are spending the money on. The bottom line is that much of this money is being spent to supplant budgets that are broken. And this is not a secret. I've talked to several of you about this the last several years. When I've testified on this issue, it's gotten much worse because nobody's minding the store at the Department of Education. When I reviewed these records in August, there had not been a staff person assigned to integration revenue in nearly a year, a full year. Both of the previous people had left the department a year earlier, and they had not refilled the position. They attempted to and had a person stay for 1 week in February of that year. So there is no accountability. There are no outcomes. I urge you not only to support this bill, but as a bleeding heart liberal, I also urge you to repeal it. It's an insulting to children of color, whom I've worked with during my entire career, to use this money that's intended for integration or achievement gap or whatever you want to interpret it, to just simply patch holes in local budgets, especially with the fiscal crisis they have. If you want to have an integration rule, please use it for integration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any other programs that you can think of that school districts are supplanting, trying to supplant money or fill in holes?
I believe that there are.
Ms. Graham?
Senator Olson, Senator Stumpf?
Such as QComp?
I totally believe that there are other programs which are also attempting to use this crutch, and I can't speak directly to those, but I can speak to this because I've done the research. Okay.
Madam Chair, I remember a legislative auditor's report that questioned the validity of and outcomes of some other programs, too. So.
Well, Senator Stumpf, I know that that was I think if you are referring to the QComp, I believe that was qualified by the fact that it hadn't been running long enough for them to have data in terms of its impact on student achievement. We've had that discussion, and I'm sure it will be revisited. But thanks.
Thank you.
Rick Lahn, Superintendent of Princeton Schools. And Brad Lundell, Schools for Equity. And if you'll, whoever goes first, give your name for the record, and welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, esteemed members of the Senate, my name is Richard Lane, and I am the Superintendent of Schools for Princeton Independent School District number 748. We are a medium-sized district with 3,400 students located 20 miles north of Elk River, right along Highway 169. We do not receive integration revenue and are far below the state average in revenue received in all categoricals. While we are only a scant 50 miles northwest of the downtown metro area, there's a striking difference in the amount of funding our district receives per adjusted marginal cost per pupil unit compared to our metro neighbors. When our founding fathers created this country and eventually the state of Minnesota, they knew an educated citizenry was essential for a democracy to survive. The provision in the Minnesota Constitution regarding education is as follows. The stability of a Republican form of government depends mainly upon the intelligence of the people. It is the duty of the legislature to establish a uniform system of public schools. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. I'm here to tell you, in the year 2011, our public school system is not uniform, nor is it equal. Due to heavy reliance on categorical funding, such as the integration revenue, students in Minneapolis public schools receive $14,404 per adjusted marginal cost per pupil unit, while students in Medford, Minnesota receive $6,932. I ask members of the Senate committee, what is uniform with a system of funding that rewards one district two times the revenue of another? We can no longer say that education and the education received in the outstate is equitable to the education received in the metro area. Compounding this problem is the fact that outstate districts are often classified as being property poor, meaning an excess operating levy is spread among fewer taxpayers creating higher property taxes to generate the same amount of revenue as their property wealthy neighbors. In Sherburne County, where our district is located, the highest foreclosure area in the state, passing excess operating revenues and levies is difficult, if next to impossible. In Princeton, we receive $8,351 for adjusted marginal cost per pupil unit, far below the state average, approximately $6,000 per pupil fewer than the Minneapolis Public Schools. As a result, we were forced to cut $2 million from our general operating budget last year. This resulted in the loss of 34 jobs from our small community. That is 34 more people on unemployment and drawing on the system to survive instead of contributing to it. Publication in Minnesota can no longer afford to look away and pretend this massive inequity does not exist. It is not constitutional, it is not ethical, nor is it right. I ask you to support this file, which will put future dollars on the basic revenue portion of the formula so all schools receive equitable funding and move away from a heavy reliance on categorical funding that steers precious resources to a scarce few school districts. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Superintendent. Brad Lundell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education. We are a 58-member organization, of which Princeton is a member. Seven or eight of our members are above the state average in terms of categorical distribution, but the other 50 or 51 are below the state average. And so we really look at the distribution of categoricals very seriously. That said, we'd have no formal position on the Section 1 of the bill, which is the desegregation portion or the integration portion. We recognize that there are unique needs in the metropolitan districts or the districts that are receiving integration aid, but that also has to be balanced against the fact that you can only spend every dollar once. And finding that balance and meeting the needs of all the children in the state of Minnesota is very, very difficult. And it's always difficult when you're talking about moving dollars around. We certainly recognize that. But by the same token, we realize that oftentimes going forward, we may be able to make some adjustments. I really wanted to jump in on Section 2
of
the bill.
Mr. Lundell, can I just insert here? I think we both learned that notion well from Senator Randy Peterson when he chaired this committee, that you can't spend a dollar more than once. So.
Madam Chair, we were sitting in this room learning that lesson over and over and over again.
So proceed.
Yeah, looking at Section 2 of the bill is the section that I really find the most compelling, and as we move forward in redoing the formula moving forward, I think it's very, very important to find the right percentage and where the distribution of categoricals and where the distribution of the basic formula should be. We are basic formula districts in schools for equity and education. Dollars, a lion's share of our school district funding comes from a basic formula. When the basic formula falls behind because of the way the categoricals are construed, we are not making up dollars there, so we're having to go out and attempt to pass levies. And given the property poor nature of our districts, that just simply exacerbates the problem, as Mr. Lane has talked about and has said, we just continually fall behind or else have to expend more effort to raise our dollars through the referendum, seeing the erosion that's happened on the equalization factors over the last 15 years. I think that, you know, whether or not the 90% number that Senator Brown has put in his bill is the correct number is anyone's guess. Should it be 85? Should it be 95? Should it be 89.367? We don't know those things. I think, but putting a number in there and working forward with that number, I think, is a valuable way to do it. This does not go as far as, you know, Senator Scavel's old student is a student bill. So I think that we are moving and saying there is a need for categoricals and there is a recognition that categoricals need to be there. The question is, how do you balance that versus the general education amount? And so with that, I would just in close saying, you know, I've worked on more task forces, funding task forces, over the last couple of decades in terms of what do we want the system to look like moving forward. And for our organization, the point always is that the basic formula needs to be at an amount that really meets the average cost or the cost of the average needs of a student, and that you start, you know, hitting your categoricals above what the average kind of average cost funding as opposed to minimum cost funding would be. And I think with the increasing reliance on the categorical, we're moving more toward a minimal cost funding system, and that leaves districts that do not receive categoricals at a distinct disadvantage, either having to pass referenda, which are getting increasingly difficult, or simply make big cuts.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Are there any questions, Senator Torsery?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Senator Brown because I'm confused now. Mr. Lane is saying that this cut that you are pursuing through this, what is the total, Mr. Neumann, what is the total cut if we move this forward, the total amount of money, if we implement these reductions?
Mr. Neumann.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think probably the best way to, I'm vamping as I'm digging for it. The bill makes a reduction beginning in fiscal 13 of $16.5 million, 18.6, 18.8. This integration is a shifted program, so it's not a clean calculation on an appropriation basis, but the dollars that you see on the front page of the fiscal note are primarily integration. They're all integration. There are no reductions.
Could you add those numbers for me? It's about $27 million, I think.
In the current biennium, it's 16.5.
16.5. Mr. Lane said, "Thank you, Madam Chair, that these reductions will be redistributed, and so that his district, Princeton Public Schools, will actually receive some of this funding. Is that correct?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Senator Torres Ray. No, that's not correct. This legislation does not direct where this savings to the state, whether it would be a savings to the state or whether it would be redirected back to the basic formula. This legislation does not stipulate one way or the other on that.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Because that was my understanding. We're reducing the education budget. And this money is not going back to the schools. So I just want to clarify, Mr. Lang, you're not going to get this money.
We understand that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Just want to make sure you knew, because you gave me the impression that you thought that this money is going to be distributed amongst the districts and that you will get the money eventually sometime. You will not.
If I gave you that impression, I apologize.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray, if you'd like to move that, we could certainly, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
No, Madam Chair, I think we should move that.
What's that?
I think we should move that this money be redirected. When we get to that point, I definitely think we ought to pursue that. This is just hacking an awful lot of money out of three school districts, and actually, I think taking a little bit more or less out of some other districts that would be brought down, I think, to the 129 per student. But it's not showing us where it's going to be used. And I think it would be nice, if we're planning to do that, that maybe then we ought to think about equalizing the dollar amount or put it someplace so that we know where that money's going rather than just taking it out of the hide of those children in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. And I'd add, I think Brooklyn Center even takes a cut in here. The irony of listening to the people from Lancaster the other day, and I know they're not dealing, I don't think they're getting 6,000 per student, but I think it was about 8 or so. And the ranking of that district and those schools being among the top in the country, not just in Minnesota, not just in Senator Stumpf's district, but in the country, with that amount of money. And then you look at the issues. I don't think that there's probably anybody there that thinks that, we'd have more money for our kids if we sent them to Minneapolis or St. Paul. And I don't know about people in Princeton, but I bet they're not flocking to come to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And, in fact, people have been flocking in the other direction. And so I just think we ought to think about these things. And I'm listening to the comments and this is all kind of just whirled up in me here. Listening to the country struggles with race, and that's been over the course of my lifetime, yours and my lifetime, Senator Olson. And I remember seeing our brand new contraption, a television, in the 50s, and seeing little brown children, which I had not seen because I grew up in lily white suburb of Minneapolis. Seeing children even attacked by dogs, hoses, other people, it had a profound effect on me at the time, and it does even now when I think back on it. And I think of where we've come, and we haven't gotten perfection yet, but we've made some progress, and we've struggled. We've struggled with busing. And I think probably it didn't work. But all the struggles we've had, and all, I hope the lessons we've learned have made us better. And we are better today. But it upsets me that we are sitting here talking about taking this kind of money from districts that can ill afford to lose any more money. And all of our districts need more. I believe that. And I think it's incumbent upon us, it behooves us to do something about that, but not just take away from somebody because we think that they have it so good. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know what people think, but I think that the kids in those districts are worth every dime. And I know that we need to do a better job of bringing every student along to achieve the level they can achieve, to have the opportunity they deserve to have. We need to do better. And I would have loved to have seen a bill come here. And you know, I could have introduced one, I guess, to improve what we do with integration revenue. But I wish we'd kind of look at our challenge here and do that rather than just hacking a big lump sum of money out of some districts that can ill afford to have that less money in the coming years. We ought to do that.
Senator Scheid, this bill is not going to be acted on, number two, if in fact this change was made, rest assured that we're not going to let it escape the Education Committee. and third is if we do lay this on the table, this puts the integration revenue on the table for a part of our consideration when we deal with putting our omnibus bill together. And we'll have there'll be a proposal. I think we will discuss it further. There's chances to amend, whatever. I can't even tell you what shape that might take, but Senator Brown has come forward with a proposal that I think they're concerned about the equity. We've heard the equity issue before, and every time you're going to talk about that, we understand that there have been, where a lot of money is going, and there's also a recognition that we still have a major achievement gap. We've got a lot of work to do, and we haven't found all of the answers. I think some of them are floating out there. And whether we can do it sitting at this table or not remains to be seen, but I hope that we will be able to help rather than hinder the kinds of efforts that do need to be done. Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Scheid, I may have misunderstood a comment of yours, but I thought I heard you say that this is going to make a cut to Brooklyn Center. This legislation does not make a cut to Brooklyn Center. It only makes a reduction to three districts, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. And overall, it will bring increases to all districts in the state of Minnesota. I do have a report here, if you'd like to look at it, the fiscal analysis did, that will show you where the cuts are, and it is specifically for those three districts.
Well, Senator Scheid, because those three, for some reason, we have specific amounts for people that are named in statute.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but I thought that you were bringing everybody to 129, and I think that Brooklyn Center gets more than that.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do, okay. 169.
Thought that they did, but if corrected. But
Senator Stubb.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for Superintendent Lane. Does Princeton participate in the QCOMP program?
Yes, we do. We do participate in the QCOMP program.
Good.
Thank you. We have a number of testifiers, and if we could just bring a cluster of them up here together. Mr. Kronquist represents AMSD, but we've got both the superintendent of Minneapolis and St. Paul here, and I believe perhaps the superintendent of Duluth as well. I'd like to have you come up, and if you can be brief so we can move on, but we do want to hear from you. Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School District. Madam Chair and members, there's an old saying that in times of a drought, the animals at the watering hole start to look at each other a little differently. Well, I think we are in a drought, Madam Chair, when it comes to education funding. No question about that. We are in the third consecutive year of the basic formula being at the same level. Statewide, we have a $550 million special education cross-subsidy, meaning that your school districts right now are taking $550 million meant for general instruction and instead spending it on mandated special education programs. We have not restored the cuts made to the extended time program in 2003, despite the fact that there is voluminous research stating that that is a highly effective means of closing the achievement gap. Minnesota has ranks very low in terms of the number of students that receive full-day kindergarten. And I think you all know we rank very poorly in terms of funding early childhood education. So clearly there's challenges, and clearly there are districts across the state, urban, suburban, rural, that are struggling mightily. All operating under the mandate of No Child Left Behind, which you all know we are under the direction to have 100% of our students operating proficiently by 2013-2014. The research is clear, Madam Chair and members, that it's not going to cost the same amount of dollars per pupil to have each of those students reach that level. The research is very clear. The PS Minnesota Task Force hired a national consultant, John Myers, many of you know, worked with all of us, a multitude of districts, education organizations. And the input we got and what the research quite clearly says is that you definitely do need to set that basic formula amount at a level that is sufficient to make sure that the average student is going to be able to meet state standards, state and federal standards. And I would definitely agree that the basic formula amount at its current level is not at that sufficient level. But the research also says you're going to need to provide additional resources based on student differentials, whether it's English language learners, special education, poverty, etc. The research also says you need to look at district cost differentials. And we do this somewhat in Minnesota. We have a sparsity revenue system in place that some may argue is not adequate, and I would not disagree with that. Transportation costs that are recognized, but again, that may not be at an adequate level. One area where we are not addressing, and that the research again supports, is the fact that some districts have higher cost of labor. And many states, I think it's about 15 states around the country, do have a component in their funding formula that recognizes this. It's a huge factor because 75-80% of a school district budget is labor cost. And the reality is that a dollar doesn't go as far in one district in terms of trying to hire labor as it does in another district. And so, as I think many of you know, those that you have been around for a while, we have argued, AMSD has argued for years, that is something that we really need to address in our funding formula. I'll stop there, Madam Chair, because we've got people a lot more expert than I following me, but thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Mr. Kronquist, could you bring an extra chair up so that both of you can join Superintendent Johnson? Superintendent Johnson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bernadia Johnson, and I'm the superintendent of the Minneapolis Public Schools. I come before you today to testify against Senate File 422, an act intended to prioritize basic revenue funding and modify other educational finance formulas. Minnesota demographics are changing significantly. By 2050, according to the state demographer, Tom Stinson, we will look very different than we do today. Today, we should be discussing what kind of state we will be in 2050. Minnesota needs a strong, coherent, and powerful integration strategy today more than ever before. This bill, Senate File 422, does not bring us closer to that goal. And I must say, 2050 looks much different than my world growing up in Selma, Alabama. This legislation diverts state supports for integration programs in three districts and freezes state aid support. compensatory and sparsity revenue for low-income learners across the state. Yet the bill retains the linkage for calculation of operating revenue cap that is so vital for suburban districts. We need to recognize that our highly diverse student population, which is an asset to our state, will be responsible for sustaining economic prosperity in the future and requires investments now. The Minneapolis Public Schools that has 33,000 students is made up of 68% students of color. 66% of our students qualify for free and reduced price meals. English language learner services are 23%. Over the past 2 years, the number of students receiving special education support and services have increased by 500 for a total of 6,570 students, or nearly 20% of our student population. In December, 3,881 students and youth in Minneapolis Public Schools, nearly 21% of our student population, were identified as homeless and highly mobile. The needs of many of our students are extensive and profound, and we must do all that we can to ensure that we meet those needs. As a major urban district, Minneapolis Public Schools has a more diverse, more mobile, and more complex body of students than most school districts in Minnesota. We consider that diversity to be our greatest strength. We believe our urban educational experiences prepare students to become active, continuous learners, and contributing global citizens. Yet that very diversity creates special challenges and requires a heightened commitment to addressing the differences in proficiency between and among our student groups. Because we must go farther and we must go faster than many other districts, we are focusing on three areas of our strategic plan, our vision for every child college or career ready. And it's supported by ensuring that we have a good teacher in every classroom, a quality leader in every school, as well as a quality school in every neighborhood. In the past year, we took several steps to ensure that we use our limited resources more efficiently. We realigned our school choice system, we're encouraging families to attend their community schools, and we continue to offer magnet choice and options because that's really important to our families. I have a folder that I hope you receive the documents in it that refer to the integration revenue in Minneapolis and how it supports our school choice transportation as well as our district magnet programs and key academic investments and support such as AVID in the middle and high school and positive behavior intervention support at our 9 racially isolated schools. Compensatory revenue supports key academic investments to close the achievement gap. And these investments are paying off in terms of gap-closing gains in early childhood to grade 1 reading and math scores and the incremental gains that we're making in our MCA scores, scores that are mirroring the state's scores as well. And we are also increasing our graduation rates across the district. I strongly believe
Superintendent Johnson, is some of that information in the material
you
provided.
I'm sorry. I thought it had gone around.
We are running out of time so fast. If you would not repeat what is in the materials, that would be helpful. If you could just kind of make the closing.
Actually, I'm not repeating what's in the statement. So I will continue. No, I'm just saying I'm not drilling down as much as what you have.
Okay,
but so I will continue.
I would love to give the other two superintendents a chance to say a little bit too.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So I urge you to take this opportunity to develop a strong policy statement and to work with districts to develop a more coherent integration strategy to make better gains for students.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Senators, good afternoon. My name is Keith Dixon, Superintendent of Schools in Duluth, and with me is Ron Hagelin, who chairs our Office of Education Equity in Duluth. I agree. I hope someday there will be a rainstorm to refill that pond up so we can add programs for kids, and I know you feel the same way.
Well, thank you for that comment. We were rather grateful with the target to at least not be having to dig deep and cut. So are we.
And so thank you so much.
Hopefully we can
that.
Do some management around this. So thank you. Continue.
Thank you. I also want to acknowledge my colleagues here, Rick, when he testified from Princeton, and Brad. I was in Faribault, Minnesota for 11 years before going to Duluth, and I can remember the change in demographics that took place in our student population there over the 11 years I was there with the food industries and what that meant. And so as a superintendent, I also acknowledge the change in demographics across Minnesota and also agree that we need to think about what to do about that. As Brad also indicated in Duluth, we're also in a property poor district, and we find it also difficult to pass levies and do those kinds of things. So a lot of that agenda that Brad talked about also resonates. I also resonate with some of the things we heard from Ms. Kirsten today. The reality is we do have the highest gap in terms of achievement between students of color in our state, and we do need to do something about that. As far as our program in Duluth, I think the reality is we've been a longstanding program. I would tell you, while voluntary, we have submitted reports every year to the Department of Education relative to our plan. And I guess I have more hope today about this. During that period of time, I think the reality has been we've been on a journey. If this was such an easy issue to solve, we would have all done it a long time ago. It simply isn't. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of commitment. And what I've seen, I think, through our journey is that the purpose of it has been we have tried a lot of things. And, yes, I would agree. What we found in Duluth as well, spending money on busing and moving students across the district didn't make a lot of sense. One of the things that's going on there, we have a large group, about 60 leaders of color, that meet with us weekly and have been for the last couple of years to really look at what we need to do about the issues in Duluth. And quickly, what I'll tell you we've heard from them is simply this. They want their children to graduate, period. And the other thing they would like is the fact that somehow we in America have a discussion about race and we start talking openly about white privilege. Because at the underlying of this is still that fundamental issue, which deals with some of the issues we're talking about. So in our case, we are making some dramatic changes in our plan. I would tell you that. I think that's positive because we have changing demographics in our community. We're looking at research. We're trying to think about how to make this happen. We're doing a lot of things that you see out of Johns Hopkins University today and Harvard and Diplomas Now programs. And yes, as Ms. Kirsten said, it is about having high expectations for all children. It is about having a robust curriculum. But I think the third thing, and I'll end with this, that we're learning is this. The reality is today we know why students drop out. It's easy. Attendance, behaviors, and failing core academic subjects. You can call them the ABCs, just a different ABC. And the reality is what has to happen today, the fundamental shift is not about money so much as it is about understanding that we have to intervene with young people at the first signs that those indicators start to exist. And where this money comes in for us is starting to think about how to use this money as interventions to support those young people when we see them in those kinds of situations. The key, though, is that this plan we have in Duluth is owned by our community. It's been developed by, with us, with our community of color. And the reality is to cut these funds right now would be dramatic for us. They own the plan. They believe in it. And I think we will show that we can make a difference over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we, does Mr. Hagel want to testify, or can we go to St. Paul Superintendent? It's
good afternoon.
Superintendent Silva.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for taking on the conversation of race, because I've been a superintendent for over a year. I've been in St. Paul for 25 years, and I can tell you that 15 years ago, our district looked exactly the opposite that it looks today. 15 years ago, we are 75% of students of color and 25% white students. We have over 72% of free reduced lunch, and 44% of our students are second language learners. And I'm not just talking about second language learners who were born in this country. As of today, we have 650 current students who just arrived in the last 6 months in our district, which is double the numbers that we have last year in a full year. These students have never been in an educational setting. Remember a couple months ago, the big storm, and I got in trouble? Remember when I closed school? Well, the next day when we opened school, as all my central office staff went to support schools, here I see these two Korean students walking with sandals because they just arrived to Minnesota. Look at what wonderful way to arrive. And they didn't have anything else. That is St. Paul reality. In every classroom, in every school, you will have diversity. We don't need to bus anybody around because we are 75%. If you look at our strong school, strong community plan, looks into how we can refocus some of the money that we are currently using for transportation to enhance what happens in the classroom. I cannot agree with you more that the fact that we have an achievement gap in this country, and we have it in Minnesota, is not the fault of anybody, but it's our current reality. I am the first Latina superintendent in the large school districts of the Council of Gray City Schools, which is 63% school district. Can you believe it? First Latina female superintendent. Why? Because we have had racial disparities for all these years. The integration dollars we get in our school district, and I will invite anybody who testified previously that they believe our dollars are misspent, I'll spend the time to show them how we spend the dollars. I tell you, as a superintendent, I expect my staff to spend the dollars on how the dollars are delivered for. We use it for, in addition, ELL services, having in transportation, which we have some choice system for our students. We use it directly in the intake when we take students and we measure how much they can hear because they come from a refugee camp, how much they can see, all the vaccinations, intake, placement center, how many people we have to translate in the different languages. We as a district have been fiscally responsible. And yes, as of last year, the plan changed on how we use integration dollars. We also have participated in the last few years in the EMED, and we are working. I meet with the EMED superintendents on how we can integrate some of the practices that we are offering St. Paul that they can use it in the school districts. I cannot tell you what I would do as a superintendent if this committee would decide to change the allocation in which my school district will lose $13.2 million in top of the $20 to $21 million if you keep every dollar the way that they are today that I have to cut. Our kids are in the most radical and difficult economical time in the last two decades. And if the families are hurting, our kids are hurting more. You heard the previous speaker talking about homeless, talk about students not having anything to eat because there's no money at home. I tell you, yes, I understand, and I hate to see ourselves as superintendents trying to get the few dollars and fighting for the few dollars because we all should be here having more dollars because education is the future of this country. And I tell you, the reality is, yes, equity is not equality. And equality is not equity. And we have to remember that. Look around yourself and tell me where's the diversity in this group of people. When was the last time that any of you have to think, would I have money for breakfast for my children tomorrow morning? St. Paul Public School, Minneapolis, Duluth, it may seem like we get a lot of money. But I tell you, we barely are making it. Our achievement gap is unacceptable. Our plan that you have seen in the last few months that we have been putting out in the community and people like or dislike, it's about equity. It's about focusing on what it works and we can replicate it. Today, we cannot afford to have 75% of our students in our district, which is 38,000 students total. And out of the 38,000 students, 29,000 of them are students of color that they cannot read at grade level. We pay today or we will pay later because eventually they will stay in the state of Minnesota. Please, I never done this before. This is my first official pleading. I want to stay as a superintendent for a while, but I can't tell you how mad and sad and frustrated I was when I saw the $129 in paper. The research, everything looks really good. Come with me and walk with me in the schools and see the needs. Let's not forget that we are talking about human beings, the next generation of learners, the next generation of future leaders. I can tell you that in less than 10 years, if we don't change how we're doing business today, this legislation is going to look exactly how it is today. 23% of our kids are white kids in our district. So when we talk about busing them, I don't know where to bus them because I only have so many to move around. So you tell me, as a white parent, if you want me to bus your kid
to the other side of the city because the kids of color need to see a white person. Because we're talking about the opposite of we talk 15 to 20 to 30 years ago. And I'll finish with this. I came to this country 26 years ago from Chile. I was an adult, 24 years old, spoke no English except going to the bathroom and some words for food. And I'm sitting here today because education is the reason that I'm sitting here today. I cannot stand in front of my next generation of children and say to them, equity is the same with equality. And that's why school districts are getting the same funding. My needs, his need, Minneapolis' need, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park's needs are very different. The cost of living, the needs of our students, and the family education that we have coming from our kids is something that we cannot overlook. With that, I feel like I'm doing a speech and telling you you misbehave and you have to go to the principal's office. But I... And you're going to tell me, yes, the results are not there. Give us a chance. Give us a chance because finally we're talking about race. And when we talk about race and we look at race as an impediment of how our kids are not learning, we may close the achievement gap in the only state in this country.
Thank you, Superintendent, and I appreciate your passion, and I also appreciate your courage in making some of the changes and recommendations in your school. I wish you well, and we need to continue to talk. These are tough times. We are listening to lots of ideas, and I appreciate that you're coming to the table to present your views and what's happened, and I'd like to know more. I've visited a couple of your schools, but I think we... all of us could stand to learn a bit more about what some of the real efforts in terms of setting the high expectations and some of the things that you found that do work, and what drives some of the, I think a lot of people, new people here as well as returning ones, need a better understanding of what drives your costs.
Senator Nelson, tell me when, and I'll be there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, quick question
for
you.
Yes, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we're running out of time. I was wondering, Madam Chair, if you would be willing at some time before we close the omnibus bill to hear the report of that group that has been working on the integration task force.
Pardon? Yeah, well, let's assess. We haven't got a whole lot of time, but let's see what we can in fact do. I printed it out. Unfortunately, the way it was printed is very hard to read. They did some fancy graphics behind the letters, and so it is not very easy. If anybody's in hearing, within hearing distance, if it just could be plain black on white, it would be nice to be able to read it. So, but thank you for that suggestion. Who do we have here?
For the record, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Griebel. I'm representing the Minnesota School Integration Council on behalf of Scott Thomas. He had to leave, so I'm presenting for him today. And I'm here to talk about...
So, Ms. Griebel, I'm complaining about the report from your group.
Yes, I know. Okay, well, we'll get you a plain black and white copy.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, on behalf of the statewide task force, as Senator Bonhoff mentioned, this is a group that really did take a comprehensive look at the current desegregation rule and the integration revenue statute and has developed some very comprehensive recommendations. We've heard a lot of presentations and testimony today about the lack of clarity of the current program, about questionable districts having questions about how to use the revenue, what are the outcomes. The Minnesota School Integration Council is speaking in opposition to Senate File 422 because we believe that integration, educational equity, these are very complex issues and require a comprehensive solution. Just changing funding formulas is not going to result in different outcomes. If we really want to address educational equity, if we really want to have different outcomes, if we want to see accountability tied to results, then we need to have a more comprehensive look at the entire desegregation rule and integration revenue program. We would be happy to come and share further information about the recommendations. But at this point, we believe that a more comprehensive approach will definitely lead to the solution that we believe we need for the future of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grable. May I just ask, having not read it, did you in fact have access or look at any data to show what achievement, what results there might be from the years that we have given this revenue for, toward that end in terms of reducing the achievement gap? Is there any evidence? I didn't confront the superintendents with that, and we've talked about experiences and things that they do, but I think that's the challenge that we're facing, is when we put our money somewhere, what is it that we get in return? And if it delivered this way, it doesn't. Could we do something different that would bring about a better result? And that's the kind of the challenge that we face from a policy perspective. Did you identify anything with the current structure and distribution of revenue that would give support to continuing it the way it is?
So, Chair Olson, committee, as has been pointed out by several different folks today, the current desegregation rule really was not designed to address achievement gap issues. And if we really want to, as a state, link our integration policy to educational outcomes, we need to start at the policy level. We need to identify those clearly measurable outcomes, establish metrics. We do believe that's possible. It's very doable. We think that integration is one strategy that can help us achieve educational equity. It's not the only solution to the achievement gap, but we do believe it's a very strong policy and structural solution to a very complex problem. There's much research out there, as has been discussed earlier. You can find research to support integrated learning and the positive impact it has on student learning, the positive impact it has on communities, on further outcomes for students when they leave education. So we do believe that we can develop a program that will lead to the outcomes that we desire as a state, but we have to start by really identifying what those policy issues are and not just playing around with the funding. It really does need to look at the full policy picture.
Well, Ms. Grable, the research seems to be not exactly conclusive in terms of the integration or integration policy. It seems to me the more that we hear from what's going on out there, that the key is still effective instruction wherever they are taught, and the quality of teaching that is going on. And I think that needs to be tested, but I think there is a fair amount of research showing that where they're located or who they're associating with may not have the same impact that just good, solid teaching and effective teachers working with these students.
Madam Chair, committee, one of the things the task force did a lot of research around was where integration has been successful and where it has been less successful. And what we've learned is that when it's successful, it's both involving structural kinds of opportunities, whether that's transportation, busing students. That's one part of the solution, but if we don't also address in-school strategies, which is, I think, what you're addressing, effective instructional practices, looking at our policies and procedures around how we identify students for gifted and talented programs, really looking at the full system of the school. If we just look at structural shifts or we just look at in-school strategies, we're missing an opportunity. We really need to look at both.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any other, are there other questions? Or,
Senator, just a quick comment, and I apologize too because I know how fast the time goes by. A few years ago, and I'm sure you remember this, the testimony from we had from Duluth School District and also Moorhead. And the testimony was around when we washed out most of the extracurricular activities like before school, after school programs, it really had a negative impact on the whole, not only the school, but the whole neighborhood. And I think when we want to achieve the maximum change, whether it's in the reducing the gap, learning gap, or whether it's in crime, or whether it's in social interaction, I think we have to really look at it in a complete, holistic way. And I think the legislation relating to career and technical education is a part of it, too. So I really think that you can create change, and certainly Superintendent Silva's testimony was very touching, too, on when you have such a high percentage of minority students in a district. I mean, you have to have programs that go beyond just the classroom. I mean, you have to have some of the, you know, I think children have to be fed. When I was down in Guatemala working down there, the person I worked with said, you can never teach somebody on an empty stomach. And I think that's true in school, too. You have to have, they have to be kind of all encompassing. So I don't know how that, you know, will develop, but one of your points, identify and support effective practices, mm-hmm. and the other one, seek partnerships and encourage collaboration. That's kind of how I tied that.
Great, thank you. Is it Dr. Dan
Jeff? Yes, it is.
Thank you very much for coming.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you this afternoon to register opposition to Senate File 422 based on its piecemeal approach to address the implementation of the current desegregation rule as well as distribution of integration revenue. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of the three metropolitan integration school districts. They are joint powers districts with over 30 school district members that together have a combined student enrollment of over 300,000 students in the greater Minneapolis-St. Paul and surrounding suburban areas. These joint powers integration districts go by the names of EMID, East Metro Integration District, WEMAP, the West Metro Education Program, and Northwest Suburban Integration School District up in the Anoka area. The integration districts and their member districts, with the very valuable assistance of hundreds of citizens who serve on their collaboration councils, voluntarily pool their funds, their knowledge, their expertise, their enthusiasm, and their commitment to provide programming and services to ultimately ensure that all students in their charge learn at high levels. Their mantra is to provide families with school choice options, to promote interracial contact, and to raise the achievement level of all students, while at the same time closing the racialized achievement gap that exists and has persisted. Among these three integration collaboratives and within their member districts, services such as the following work towards those ends. First are school choice options for families, which include two regional magnet schools in EMID, two more regional magnet schools in WEMAP, along with the Choice is Yours program, and 10 magnet programs that operate within Northwest Suburban Member District schools. Significant staff training in multicultural teaching techniques for thousands of teachers and other school personnel in the region, including the availability of multicultural resource centers for teachers, students, and families. Then we serve individual students through programs such as Dare to Be Real, Elders Wisdom Children's Song, 100 Strong, The Brotherhood, Love in the Skin I'm In, Future Educators Club, and many, many more. These are but just a few examples of the great work that is being done to accomplish our important objectives. As to SF 422, I'll reiterate that we oppose any piecemeal approach such as this to address the implementation of the current desegregation rule and the distribution of integration revenue. Rather, we support, like others, the adoption of a new desegregation rule based on the recommendations of the Minnesota School Integration Council. We believe that then and only then, after a comprehensive review and modification of the expectations and intended outcomes as expressed by the new rule, then should the funding for any districts, especially those identified in SF 422, be considered. We believe that to pull the string, so to speak, that would unravel the fabric of the coalitions, collaboratives, and voluntary joint work of the districts identified in Senate File 422 and their numerous school district and other partners would precociously and negatively affect thousands of students, educators, and families. Thus, we urge the committee to reject Senate File 422 and to instead consider the recommendations of the Minnesota School Integration Council as a basis for any reform to the Minnesota Desegregation Rule and its companion integration revenue. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. What might be helpful, too, have you got any data that shows kind of some of the track record or achievement of these integrated districts, integration districts?
I'm not sure. I understand your question.
Well, in terms of student achievement or the achievement gap issue, is there any way that you have of tracking what some of that evidence? You describe kind of what you do. But do you have any way of conveying or just communicating what the results are?
Madam Chair and Committee, we have some preliminary results that I'd be happy to share with you, but I
appreciate
do not have widespread systemic results. And I would remind Madam Chair and the Committee that in terms of the desegregation rule and integration revenue, only in 2009 was language added that focused on the achievement gap, and that became an expectation. So I don't offer that as an excuse, but the reality is that the rule had a much different purpose, as has been alluded to a number of times.
Yeah.
Now our focus since 2009 has shifted far more in that direction, and you would see that in the plans that districts submit. So it's a bit premature, but we're optimistic.
Thank you, Dr. Jett. We may not have had it, and we talk about it closing the achievement gap, but student achievement should be an underlying goal no matter what, and that, what kind of progress is being made in terms of improving student achievement toward our standards or growth or however one way in which it would be conveyed. It would be helpful to see if you can know how we can access that. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Senator Hand?
Just a quick question, Madam Chair. I'm not familiar. I'm seeing the Minnesota School Integration Council. What is that? Who is it? Who's involved with it? When was it formed? I don't know anything about it, just other than what you've said here today, and Senator Bonhoeff has referred to it. Could somebody? One question is this something Myron Orfield is a part of, or is this? No, please tell us what it is.
So, Madam Chair, Senator, the Minnesota School Integration Council is a statewide organization. We are a completely voluntary-run organization, mainly practitioners from around the state that are involved in or interested in educational equity. And so it's primarily school district employees, but not solely. We have members from higher education and other nonprofit organizations as well. We've been in existence for a little less than a year and a half, so we're a fairly new organization. And we really came to this task force work a little bit by accident. In the last omnibus bill, there was language to have the legislature create a task force to do this work, to study the desegregation rule and the integration revenue statute. But with no omnibus bill, there was no task force. And so our group approached then Commissioner Segrin about the possibility of working with the Department of Education to convene this group, and so with their support and endorsement, we then proceeded to establish a task force. The task force met beginning in October and concluded their work in January of this year.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. We've got one more issue that we need to take before us. We've moved this one bill from it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Brown. We're going to lay this bill on the table. We'll have further discussion of this in the context of other proposals around our funding formula. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the hearing on Senate File 422.
Thank you. I think this has been a healthy discussion for us. So we have another issue. We are delaying the Senator Senjum's bill until next Tuesday. And the one that I have is just a small issue that won't take long when we take it up. We don't need to do that today. But we do need the report back from the department on the Blue Sky virtual school that I think has been communicated. We've been getting some communications on, and just to see what the status of this is.
Madam Chair, before we move into this,
Senator Torres-Ray,
if I may, unfortunately, Senator Brown was dismissed, so he left quickly.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make a comment because, obviously, members, this is a big deal for my district. Mm-hmm. This is a huge deal, and I cannot just say, oh, okay, we're going to try to figure out what to do. As you heard the superintendents, this will be a tremendous cut for the district. And I just wanted to leave for the record, and I think you, Madam Chair, and some of the senior members actually know that I want to say this to the members, the new members, that I have worked extensively on this. And I have been incredibly critical of the districts and how we go around, you know, doing formulas and not understanding who receives what when and what is happening today. And Senator Scheid and I have been talking about the change in her district and how we're not paying attention to that and somehow think that St. Paul and Minnesota are the only ones dealing with this kind of huge increase in poverty and diversity, but there are other districts who are suffering. And what I hope that you heard today is that we need to look at policy. We are not going to resolve these education problems just by looking at this formula today. I guarantee you right now that a week from now we're going to hear another formula, and a member is going to come and try to cut another piece. And then a year from now, somebody's going to come with another one. I have been here for 4 years going after this year after year. We need to look at policy. Members, I implore you, especially the freshman members who I know come with very good intentions of making a difference. I really believe in that. I don't think that you will be here if you wouldn't have good intentions and resolving these problems for all of our children, children of color, low-income children. I believe that. But this does not resolve our problem. Cutting funding from one district today and then going after your district tomorrow is not a solution. What we need to do is look at these recommendations that were put in place by the state auditor, by these individuals who voluntarily came and say, okay, take a look at how you do business. This is not a good way. We have a report, the PS Minnesota report, that really did extensive analysis of our formulas. That report is there for you to look at. We need to resolve these formulas. And I hope that you don't punish districts. I really sincerely hope that you don't punish my district because we were incapable of resolving these formulas at this level. So I have to say this, Senator, because Madam Chair, because this is very problematic for the Minneapolis School District, and it will be for St. Paul. This is not insignificant. And so as we move along, Madam Chair, I just really hope that we resolve policy issues, that we just don't try to resolve a deficit on the back of our children, especially the most vulnerable and the poorest in the state of Minnesota.
Well, we're thank you, Senator Torres Ray. We are tackling some tough issues. We know there are lots of challenges in education. I think we have some opportunities, and I hope we can make the best use of that to try to bring about some changes that will move us in the right direction. We may not have all the resources, but there's still $14
billion? Yeah.
There's a lot of money being spent on education, and if we can change some policies that we'll get better results with that money, that's what we need to try to do. And if it's us that are getting in the way, I hope we can change that as well. So thank you very much. Ms. Hermanson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rose Hermanson. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. We thank you for this opportunity to visit with you about another serious issue. We've been asked to share information about our decision as it relates to the Blue Sky Charter School. Earlier today, I did forward some documentation and information to the chair, and also there should be letters in your packets, the exact letters that were sent both to Blue Sky and to their authorizer, Novations. And so that should be before you as well. I'm going to make some general comments, and I have with me today Mr. David Hartman, who is the head of our charter school center at the Department of Education, to provide more details. I think Senator Olson kind of alluded earlier, I've been at the department since February, the first part of February, and was brought in kind of in the middle of this process, which was actually started with the previous administration. And we will try to answer questions as best we can here. I would like to kind of let you know up front that our comments will be somewhat tempered by a few things. We're going to have to be a little bit circumspect because there are data privacy issues in this discussion. There's also potential legal action in this discussion, and we also want to be respectful of the relationship between authorizers and the schools, the contract between the authorizers and the schools. And I know that we have new members on this committee, and we may have to maybe do some explaining about how this works, and hopefully we can answer those questions. I'd also like to let you know that we've been receiving advice and guidance from the Attorney General's office in this matter. And part of the reason I'm here, you'll see that the letters you receive are signed by Deputy Commissioner Jesse Montano. The process lays out, and the commissioner, by the way, we have put a firewall or attempted to put a firewall around the commissioner because in the appeals process or hearing process, she's the one that makes a decision. So at this point, she has not been involved with what you will hear today. Deputy Commissioner Montano signed the documents, and she will in turn represent that findings to the commissioner if there is a hearing on this matter down the road. First, I'd like to share with you that we did not make this decision lightly. We hope that we've taken the necessary deliberative and care and focused our decision on the students and what's happening with students. The issue was brought to us by complaints to the department probably close to 2 years ago now. Our role is to address those complaints and investigate and make a decision. There have been numerous communications exchanged during this period. I think, Madam Chair, we have kind of copied you on a lot of those in an email that we sent earlier today. So if the committee wants more detail, we can supply that to them on those communications. It was only after fairly thorough investigation and analysis of the material supplied by Blue Sky, you know, this was the data going back and forth during this period, that we then made a decision. The final decision was based on that information and the impact on students, and in particular those graduating on February 10th, 2011. That was the date identified by Blue Sky as the graduation of the students that we focused our investigation primarily on, and because we had the complete documentation on those students. The process is ongoing. Blue Sky remains open until the process is completed. We also want to know that there is a hearing on the there is a hearing available for Blue Sky on this, and that will be part of this process should they choose to go to hearing. And having made those general comments, I'm going to turn to Mr. Hartman and let him explain some more of the detail of the investigation and how we are proceeding.
Could I just clarify a couple things that you just said? Since one of my constituents had contacted me rather with a daughter that is about to complete, I think had a couple of classes expected to graduate in May, and if this is if the shoe drops on March 21st. She apparently, you know, has taken this as an alternative type of school and rather fragile. And the mother doesn't want to. She got a response from the Department of Education that maybe she should choose another choice school. And she said, I cannot bring that before my daughter. So you said the school will remain open
until
the procedure. And what does that mean, and when is that? Would that person be able to continue and complete or what?
Madam Chair, we have asked Novations, the authorizer, to report to us what they intend to do, and Mr. Hartman can go through that too, by March 21st. That process, then there are options within for hearing and other options for Blue Sky. We, until the entire process is completed, we don't know what Novations is going to do yet. Should they, once they've made their decision, then there's other things that will take place. And until the entire process completed, Blue Sky stays open. And so there will be a time period here that we want to continue this process with everybody involved. Now, we have had calls from parents. They are concerned, legitimately so. We have students, in all different grade levels in this, and we are attempting to work with parents on this, but at this point it's too early to say exactly when this process will be completed.
Okay. Is it Mr. Hartman?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Olson, members. My name is David Hartman. I'm the acting supervisor in the Charter Schools Office at the Minnesota Department of Education. My role in the office, our office, oversees the workings of charter schools, and specifically we oversee authorizers, and so we run the process through which authorizers earn approval, and through them we hold authorizers accountable to those expectations through which they hold charter schools accountable through the contracts that they sign with them.
Now, and Mr. Hartman, this particular authorizer has gone through that process and been approved to carry on that role?
Correct. Novation went through the process last spring and was approved in May of 2010.
Thank you.
So to walk through kind of a bit of a timeline, I'm more on the receiving end of this. Our office does not handle academic standards complaints. Where this has ended up is dealing with the authorizer, and so that's why I'm addressing this today. But I'm not the expert when it comes to the curriculum or the transcripts for students, so that's just a disclaimer on all that. So starting in February of 2009, the department notified Blue Sky that there were significant concerns and that the department would be conducting an investigation with an independent contractor regarding credits, science curriculum, and math curriculum. By June of 2009, that had been completed, and the department contacted Blue Sky and identified 12 areas of noncompliance, and those you can see in a letter of June of 2009. There's a page 2 that identifies 12 areas of noncompliance in math, science, and having to do with credits. In winter of 2010, the department determined that several of those 12 areas were unresolved and followed up with a second audit with an independent contractor going to the school, reviewing transcripts, reviewing curriculum submitted by the school. The findings that were identified in spring of 2009 identified 12 plus 4 areas of noncompliance. The additional areas of noncompliance were in social studies. So graduation, science, math, and social studies. There's a follow-up identifying those concerns. There were in June of 2010 where some of those areas with additional follow-up from the school had been considered resolved. And there were 8 or 9 unresolved issues that were identified back to the school. The school followed through with some response at the end of August of 2010. The department reviewed that information, and as of November 1st, 2010, the department identified 11 unresolved issues. And so the letter that was filed, or letters, one to Blue Sky, one to Novation, were a result of the November 1st concerns that had been identified. So over the course of 2 years, several issues have been identified throughout as a course of these audits, and several issues have persisted and gone unresolved. So,
Senator Nelson, do you want to interject a question right now?
Or maybe at the end of your testimony. I just wanted to have a question at the end.
Okay, thank you.
So as of this week, The department determined that the gravity of the determination after 2 years of considerations prompted direct notification to the authorizer. Because we respected the contractual relationship between the authorizer and the school that exists. And so that's the primary responsibility. So through our office, we have a secondary role. The initial role of the school and the authorizer is for the authorizer to oversee the compliance identified within the contract. Some of that is identified in the charter school law. And many of the findings identified as an outcome of these many audits deal specifically with subdivision 10 of the charter school law, which reads, a charter school must design its programs to at least meet the outcomes adopted by the commissioner for public school students. The findings were that the curriculum did not align with state standards, and more specifically, that there were students that had graduated that had not satisfied all of the credit requirements in the multiple areas required in state law. As of yesterday, the department met with Novation Education Opportunities, the authorizer, and we presented them with the results of the MDE process. They're in the midst of engaging in further review of that information, and we are deferential at this point until the 21st of March to allow them to make their own determination relative to the information that we've presented to them.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think the bottom line is saying, the bottom line is of this is students are graduating and given diplomas that have not met the state required standards to be a graduate in Minnesota, and these are established by law, and that has been the ongoing discussion with Blue Sky. We have the standards in law, we have the process in law, and as a department, we are working both with the process of authorizers to school, which is one, and also the requirements of what you've laid out in law that you that students must meet in order to be graduating.
And may I just ask, is this criteria that's applied to all charter schools, and do you give the degree of scrutiny that has been given to this one to all of the rest of them as well, or is it just because somebody's complained about something, that's what's brought it to attention, and therefore they are getting the oversight?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did have complaints brought to us. It's then our obligation to investigate and follow through on those complaints, and that's what precipitated this entire process that we've worked through over 2 years with the school to determine whether they were they were graduating students without meeting the standards and their graduation requirements.
So, Ms. Hermanson, are you free to say whether this was complaints from students that had participated, or where the source of the complaint was, just in a categorical sense, not individuals?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can address, I know that in one instance, and I'd have to verify this, that they came from staff at the school. And I guess I'm not aware if there were additional complaints or not. I would have to check on that.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for clarifying this. We've had a lot of communication about this recently, and that's a great concern if we have students who are graduating that have not met standards, and especially if it's been going on for 2 years. So that's a great concern. I guess my question really, though, is one more about process. And as we were hearing the report, there were, you know, all these different, citations or elements of noncompliance, so to speak. And what I would really like to know is, have there been direct person-to-person conversations with the administration or the authorizer? I'm not sure who the correct person would be at Blue Sky to really try and determine and identify exactly what standards aren't being met. And we know that when curriculum is delivered online, a lot of times it's delivered in a different fashion than what we are traditionally used to seeing in the classroom. So if it's a matter of not seeing standard, is the issue or one of the issues the fact that you were not able to ascertain that certain standards were being taught in the curriculum? And if that's the case, then you know, did you look at all the curriculum, or was it just not in the place where you thought it should be?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we had independent audits. We did give feedback.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
And we also did, I mean, we have tried to communicate during this process as to what we are looking for. And I, as I said earlier, I think we've supplied quite a bit of documentation to the chair, which we can also supply to you. It's about 40-some pages. We have attempted to convey what our needs are and what we are looking for in this process. Like, as I started out saying, we didn't take it lightly. We have had reviews of transcripts and of the curriculum, and I guess after repeated requests and there's been a lot of data exchanged, we still had not gotten to our satisfaction the information we needed to assure ourselves that students were graduating with the required required standards embedded in that curriculum.
Senator Steven.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who to direct this to. I don't know if this is from you, Senator Nelson, but I was just curious who wrote this.
This was delivered to me from Dr. Donald Hanlon, the interim director.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ivanka.
Madam Chair, is it your intention that we would also hear from Blue Sky today, or did you just want an update from the department?
Well, we've had a very respectful audience that's loaded this side of the room, and I suspect maybe some of those folks are from Blue Sky, and I don't know if you have a representative or two that would wish to speak that would give that. I think that's only fair.
Great.
Thank you for asking, and I hope you don't object to that as well.
Madam Chair, no, we do not object. You know, like I said, we started out with some general comments to
yes.
you, and this is an ongoing process. And
sure. Thank you very much for that. And, yeah, is there someone who would like to discuss that? And it may be good for you folks to hear that as well. Identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. But for the record, my name is Dr. Don Hanlon, and I have to apologize. I got this document that has been referenced by some of you to several of your offices today, but not all of them. So if we can have some assistance, everybody can have a copy that does not currently have this right now
certainly.
On the committee.
Got it.
Thank you. In running around the Capitol complex, some of your offices are in some of the most peculiar places, and I'll tell you what, I just flat out struggled to find where you were. And further, many of you were in committee
Dr.
meetings.
Dr. Hanlon, some of us are having a hard time finding ourselves, too.
I can appreciate that.
Thank you.
For the record, let me put a little bit of – oh, accompanying me up here is Cindy Lavorato, who is our legal counsel for Blue Sky, and we also have Eugene Piccolo, who is the executive director for Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. We also have Brian Rossi, who is executive director for Novation, so that is the authorizer for the Blue Sky schools here. Just as a point of perspective for the committee, since this investigation started over 2 years ago, I am the fourth now interim director of Blue Sky Schools for one reason or another. In that same period of time, the school has put, as part of the corrective action plan from the Department of Education, a total new learning management system in place, and they put a total new curriculum in place, the Aventa curriculum, which, by the way, is the same curriculum that the Department of Education has put a grant for and placed in schools in northeastern Minnesota. So there's 8 schools up there that are using the exact same curriculum. Well, not the exact same curriculum. Because of the corrective action plan, we have had our staff working on alignment issues. And just for the record, would you please bring up the boxes up here, the curriculum here, and the documentation that we have provided the Department of Education. I don't want to bore you with all of this. All of you are able to read the comments that I have here. As you can see, this was not a casual exercise for Blue Sky School to try and satisfy the Department of Education. Take a look at this. And oftentimes this data was asked for in a matter of months to produce it. So if you look here, I'm just going to highlight several of the points that I have on this document that I prepared for you, and then I'll turn the floor over to either Cindy or to Eugene here. I'll start with number one. In my 30-plus years of educational work in the state of Minnesota, I've never seen this kind of documentation required of any school district. And talking to my colleagues who span from every corner of this state to every border of it, they've never seen this required by any school in the state of Minnesota. Makes one ask a question. If you jump down to number four, you can see this is a summary of what we have here. Just a bullet point number four here. It says there's 17 binders here, over 6,000 pages of documents addressing the curriculum. Now, one of the struggles that we have had with Blue Sky, and I allude to this in several of the points here, as we've worked with the Department of Education, they continue to change the target. They say on one point, this is what we want you to have. But then when we provide it for them, they say, well, that's not exactly what we wanted you to have. We'd really like it a little bit different. So we see that we've continued to try to satisfy them. If you, I'll turn the page to the second page. Number eight, as the bullet point number eight, I would like to read that one for you, specifically because Mr. Hartman pointed out one of the issues we had is that the department raised the issue of the social studies standard. But I'd like to read from you a quote that was found in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune this week. Beth Awney, MDE curriculum specialist, is quoted in the March 6, 2011 Star Tribune article saying that we are going to have fewer social studies standards and benchmarks than before. The current standards are very difficult and some would say impossible to teach with integrity. The department has been holding public meetings around the state to review social studies government standards. And I made a typo here. In the second meeting that was held in Marshall, only one person showed up for the public meeting, and that was a Blue Sky social studies teacher. Then that next little bullet point, it says, these are the same confusing standards that MDE is judging Blue Sky on, saying we are not adequately meeting them. In the shadow of this information, MDE has publicly stated that they were going to close Blue Sky because we weren't able to meet the social studies standards, among others. Now, how can one meet the standards when the State Department, by its own admission, says they're impossible to meet? Yet they're holding us to a standard and say, you better meet those things or we're going to close you down. Kind of tough to do that. If you jump down to number 10, says bullet point number 10, prior to meetings that we've had with Beth Awney, and you can see that in number 9, we had discussed meeting the requirements for documentation with Catherine Olson down to very detailed items on MDE's rubric. This is the same rubric that was used for organizing Blue Sky supporting information. Upon their arrival, the Department of Education to Blue Sky for a review, they told us that the information was not organized correctly, even though the organization was what a ranking member of the department said met their criteria earlier on in our preparation. For your information, Catherine Olson told Blue Sky while a site visit at Blue Sky that she has no educational experience and was very frustrated when asked educationally oriented questions of us. I'm not sure quite what that means because she works at the Department of Ed, but that's what she told one of our staff members. Number 12, again, I alluded to this already. The Department of Education put a grant in place to put the Aventa curriculum up in northeastern Minnesota schools, and then they've turned around and told us that the Aventa curriculum doesn't meet the Department of Education standards. And we've worked to align it exactly to the standards that were here in the state. When I've asked for clarification of content prior to submitting documents, MDE staff have told me that it was not their role to clarify what the submittal should be. It was only their role to judge after the documents have been submitted. Again, this is evidenced by the 17 binders. I had spent, when I first got to Blue Sky, as you say, I've only been there 4.5 months. I had called the Department of Education asking for clarification. They said, that's not our role. We're only here to judge what you submit to us. That's very difficult for any school district to meet what that criteria is that the State Department is looking at when they say, no, we're just going to come in, we're going to give you a red check mark and send you to detention or someplace like that. You can see some of my other notes along the way. I will just say that today, based on the meeting that was held with Mr. Hartman and Novation yesterday, we hired an independent person who specializes in both curriculum and in the ability to interpret transcripts. He looked at the transcripts from the February graduates, and he said every one of them met state standards and deserved to graduate. Not one of them was graduated incorrectly. Now, part of it, you say, well, why would that be? Well, one of the problems is we've asked MDE. We have a very unique high-risk population that attends Blue Sky School. They come to us from multiple schools all over the state of Minnesota, and many of those people may have gone to 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. They're the same population that you talked about with the integration revenue earlier today. They've come through all these different schools. Then they come to Blue Sky and say, you're our last hope because we don't have another choice out there to find a school to graduate from. And so we have to go to all these different schools. Our counselors spend hours talking to the other schools across the state of Minnesota and say, what is in your curriculum? Because we have to make sure our students have covered every one of the standards required by state. Upon a detailed evaluation of that, this person today said, every one of those kids graduated. That's not a problem. But he said, you are right. This is so complex, so difficult, because of the nature of your students, where they're coming from, and how we have to look at those credits. You have to sort out every credit. And the State Department said, it's our obligation to call the school districts that are sending the kids there. We have to ask them about the content in their courses to make sure that they're hitting the standards. They say, you can't accept if they say they have an Algebra 1 course or an Algebra 2 course. They said, that's not universal in the state of Minnesota. You have to go and ask them specifically what standards were covered in that school district, whether it's Thief River Falls or Minneapolis or Duluth or Two Harbors or wherever it happens to be. We have to call each of those schools and say, what's the content of that? Now, the reason I'm telling you this is we have tried to share this with the Department of Education. We said, we have all this documentation. I have a notebook here like this on the 10 graduates that shows detailed evidence about every one of those standards for that student, copious notes from the social workers, from the counselors that says, this is how they met that standard. We have delved into those standards so deeply that, quite frankly, we probably know them better than the Department of Education. And so when we have gone in there on an individual basis and said, this is how this student has graduated, when we tried to share that with MDE, they said, oh, no, we don't want to see that. Just give us the transcripts. We know what we're doing. But you can't do that with these high-risk students. They are unique, absolutely unique, and you can't treat them like the other kids in brick-and-mortar schools. And if you do, they're going to fail. Now, if you close Blue Sky School or if MDE is successful in doing that, where are these students going to go? Because they came to us because they ran out of options in the brick-and-mortar schools. Where are they going to go? That's a major question that we're concerned about.
Senator, thank you. I may interrupt you just briefly because Senator Torres-Rae has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to figure out what is that we can do as a committee with respect to this.
I'm not sure. This was more for information gathering for us, okay. And then I think we do need to. I don't know if you want to call it an anecdote, but it is something that's exercising, something that's being exercised as a basis of what we have in policy and law
Absolutely.
Now. So I think it's very valid that we learn what the impact of that is or how it's being implemented. And it's not something we may be able to respond to at this moment, but I think it gives us hopefully a background for some thought and determination to see what we might do to, you know, to protect or correct or whatever does in fact need to be done.
And what I'll finish up, because you guys have been so patient here, you've been sitting here for a long time, as has Blue Sky people and people who are interested in this, and we see that this has ramifications not only for Blue Sky, but the process that involves all charter schools, and that's why we asked Mr. Piccolo to be here. I'm going to ask just three things, and then I'll be open for questions, or we can turn it over to these people, depending upon how you want to go, Madam Chair. There's three things that we think would be a good solution for you as a committee. Number one, we think that you should appoint, not MDE, an independent person investigator to review the documents generated by Blue Sky School, and specifically our transcripts, and taking the time to talk with us. and our counselors to say, here's the documentation. It's not made up. We're working with other schools' information, and we're putting it together in a consolidated document, but it takes a lot of explanation because it's very, very complex. It's unlike any other transcripts you're going to see, your kids are going to see in your school, or apparently what MDE has seen. We think that an independent person should come in who is skilled and has that ability, and I think then that takes us out of it, it takes the Department of Ed, and it gives you confidence on what's happening. Second thing, I think you should have an independent person investigate how MDE has been working with charter schools and with authorizers. We have a sense, and I can't speak to this for all charter schools, we have a sense that what you have put in law is not exactly what's taking place, and I'll let others talk about that. And then the third thing would be we really would like MDE to stop this investigation on us pending the outcome of what that investigation is. We don't need to give them another 17 volumes of document. We're trying to teach kids, and this takes time away from what we're doing. We have limited resources, like everybody has limited resources. We would like to spend our time working on our students and their education, and we would appreciate if you would put a note to MDE and say, just back off, let the independent investigators do it. And with that, I'm open to questions, or we can open up to what these other two people would have to say.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I see Dr. Melcher approaching. I don't know if you're interested in commenting or if you're interested in escaping. Sorry about that, Dr. Melcher.
Dr. Melcher.
Yeah. Is Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just never really got an answer to my question the first time around, so I'll just ask it again. We see there's been a lot of papers, and we know that a lot of complex things in life can't get solved by trading papers back and forth.
Correct.
And what I would like to know is how many face-to-face or how often have you had face-to-face discussion with the department to try and figure out exactly what the problem is?
Two times.
In 2 years?
Yes.
Dr. Hammond?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So it's been a paper communication?
Yes. We've asked for having other face-to-faces, but MDE has refused to do that. They said, we've given you our paper version. That's all you need.
Okay. Is there anybody else at the table that would like to add to Dr. Hamlin's testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Lavarato, and at the present time, I'm general counsel for Blue Sky Online School, and I'm going to keep this short. I know it's been a long day, but I want to let you know something critical, I think. I'm here not only as Blue Sky's attorney, but I'm also here as somebody who represented the Minnesota Department of Education for 15 years as a special assistant attorney general. I was also an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education for a year and a half. I have a lot of fondness and respect and affection for the people who work at that department and do a good job and try their best every day. And it saddens me to have to be here. I mean that sincerely. But I have to tell you something, and this is, it's not easy to say in public, and I'm probably taking a risk, but I need to say this. In more than 26 years of doing education law, I have never seen the outrageous miscarriage, I have never seen anything that resembles what I have described as an outrageous miscarriage of justice that MDE has perpetrated against Blue Sky for the past 2+ years. If I may, I would like to provide a brief overview since Senator Nelson and Madam Chair have asked some questions about the process. I think it might be helpful for you to have a sense of what has and hasn't happened, and I'll make it brief if you would permit me. I want to let you know that we have tried to handle this matter discreetly. We have not played this out in the press. Until yesterday, we have not contacted legislators. We have not done anything to turn this into a media circus. And as a matter of fact, a month ago, I approached a representative of the Minnesota Department of Education at the Attorney General's office, and I sat down with her. She's a former colleague. And I gave her way more information than I'm about to give you. And I said to her, in fact, I pled with her, please take this to your client. Bring this to their attention. Don't let them continue on the path that the previous administration was following. It was erroneous. It's bad. Stop it. Take a look. And the result was that on March 7th, the Minnesota Department of Education sent a letter to Blue Sky Online Charter School basically saying, we've worked with you for 2 years. It's futile to continue. We're not giving you any more process. We're directing the authorizer to tell us whether or not the school will be closed down by March 21st. And if it isn't, we will consider taking action to close the school. And as Madam Chair has pointed out, MDE has directed parents to go somewhere else. MDE has told students and families, this isn't a good school. You need to go somewhere else. I want to ask you, if this was happening in a traditional public school, if the Minnesota Department of Education was doing this to a school in your district, I leave the question open. So here's my overview. Well, before I say that, I want to say this. Ms. Hermanson, who I have the most regard for, I worked with her. She was a colleague of mine as an assistant commissioner. And I think she's in a tough position, and I understand she's trying to step into an awkward situation. She's indicated that there is an opportunity for a hearing. And I want to tell you that we have not had a hearing. We have been tried and convicted in the press, and we have not had a hearing, in spite of repeated requests for a hearing. And that may be how people do it in other states. That's not how we do it in Minnesota. This is not how we run government in Minnesota. So let me just quickly give you a walkthrough of what happened. And I have more than enough documents to support what I'm going to say. I'd be happy to supply the documentation to any member of the committee that would like it. Around the 1st of December 2008, MDE fully approved Blue Sky's curriculum and gave Blue Sky approval for 5 years as an online authorizer. That was December of 2008. The end of December of 2008, and this is a pattern you're going to see consistently, in response to complaints from anonymous sources that were not revealed to the school, MDE reversed its previous decision, said, nope, you're under investigation, contacted somebody to do a curriculum audit. A curriculum audit, by the way, was unprecedented in MDE history, never been done. The individual that MDE contacted to conduct this audit refused to do it. And she did it in writing, and I have the letter. And it says, this is a flawed process. You should not do it. I'm not going to compromise my integrity by being a part of this. And she refused. But MDE continued, mostly on the basis of complaints by two fired employees who were disgruntled and who continue to this day to be disgruntled and to make noise in the press. And absolutely unfounded allegations. Mostly on the basis of that, MDE continued its investigation. They hired a different auditor. And that auditor took steps to review the analysis, or the documents, rather, given to him. In May of 2009, MDE representatives met with the school to advise them of the... May I continue, Madam Chair?
Proceed.
To advise them of the results of the audit. And at that time, and I have notes that reflect this, an MDE representative said, you're no better or worse than any other school. This is, you're okay. You need to do some stuff. You need to make some changes. But on the whole, you're okay. And MDE now claims that it sent a curriculum audit report to Blue Sky Online Charter School. We have no record of it. Nobody recalls having received it. In the voluminous documents that I've looked at, I cannot find any evidence that it was ever transmitted.
Senator Steven?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask a question, I think, of the department. But on there, and this is in response or following up on Senator Nelson's point, everything I see from the Department of Education, which is only two sheets, says that it's delivered by email and certified mail. I was just questioning, wanted to know from the department if that's always their policy when there's an investigation that they'd have things delivered by certified mail so that there is a record of it having been sent and received.
Is there somebody that would like to respond to that from the department?
Madam Chair, Ms. Senator Steven, I'm not. We sent it by email and certified mail. In this instance, I can't answer for what was taking place during the previous administration on all of their communications. I would have to go and check.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I continue?
Yes.
Thank you. We have no record of any certified mail being sent to Blue Sky. I cannot find in these documents email transmittal. It may be there. I may have missed it, but I cannot find it. And nobody at the school, including the next interim director and the administration, ever saw it. Nothing happened from June of 2009 till the following February 2010, 10 months, almost 10 months from the date that the audit was initially completed. And at that point, because of continued complaints from former fired employees, MDE sent a letter to the interim director of Blue Sky at that time and said, you have a day and a half to respond. You've had since last June, you have a day and a half to respond. And they were given a day and a half. And they did the best that they could in a day and a half. And that wasn't sufficient. The results were not communicated to the client, to my client, to Blue Sky School. And another audit was conducted by the same individual who then sent that to the school. And at that point, in April 26th, I believe, 2010, the school was told, you're done. It's over. You have no further opportunity to appeal or discuss this. You should have complied, and you did not. I'm going on too long, and you can tell I feel strongly about this, and I do. The bottom line is this. Today, the department has represented that it would like to really rely on the authorizer to work out this issue, and I would welcome that. But let me tell you something. The department's role to this point has been an overabundance of oversight, micromanaging, and unreasonable behavior. And so what I would like to ask this committee is to direct the department, if you have it within your authority, and I believe you do, to either to finish up the investigation, bring this matter to a hearing, or complete it, or let the authorizer do their job. We just cannot afford to spend any more time providing multiple documents, having the target changed, and then asking for more documents because the first round wasn't sufficient. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and I'm happy to stand for any questions the committee might have.
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to I'm trying to understand. I'm reading through these materials, too, and I see there's a letter here from the department to Brian Rossi of Novation, and in the second paragraph under the heading determination on the first page, it just says that the department is directing Novation to respond by Monday, March 21st, on whether Novation will notify Blue Sky that it is either terminating or not renewing. And then it says if Novation does not respond or decides not to proceed to terminate, then the department is going to terminate. So my question is, when you say you want the department has asked the authorizer to do its job, it seems as if the job is to terminate your contract. Is that what you're asking for?
No. Senator, Madam Chair, Senator, if I communicated that message to you, I deeply apologize. What we would like to have happen is for the investigation to be stopped. It's been 2 years. Make a decision. Either get out of the business of authorizing the authorizer or let the authorizer do their work. But micromanaging on top of what an authorizer has done. And let me just point out, MDE approved the transfer to this authorizer in August of 2010. And then they reversed themselves in November and said, no, you're still not doing it. We're going to start taking $18,000 away from you. We pushed back. We asked for their authority and for a hearing. And now they have, I just heard today from the Attorney General's office, they have decided that they are no longer going to proceed with withholding action. Now they're going to shift their emphasis to the authorizer. You know, take the liberty of making a policy statement here. This was the first state to enact charter school legislation. It's been a grand policy experiment. And part of what's happened over the years is that the legislature has really struggled with how much oversight do we want to give to MDE, how much do we want to transfer to authorizers, how many of the laws should apply to charter schools. And in 2009, the legislature transferred a lot of the oversight authority to authorizers. And I think this represents, and actually the department was quoted as saying this in the paper, this is sort of a test case about whether and to what extent you want MDE involved in the oversight of charter schools. This shouldn't be a test case. This should be a case-by-case determination based on the facts in this case. But to date, this is the level of oversight we've had. And I would respectfully ask that some direction be given so this comes to an end, one way or the other. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Piccolo, do you wish to speak at all, or are you there just for moral support? Or?
Madam Chair, members, I'm here for moral support, but also just want to make one or two comments. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things watching this process for the last 2 years, there is concern about the processing of things. There does not seem to be consistent processes in oversight and in the role. And I know we have been going through a process of transition from the old law to the new law. And I think some of this is a result of that and people not knowing their roles as we go through this process. But I do have concerns that, and we have seen it with the review, with the approval process, how long it's taken for things to get done. And so we do have concern about the processes within the Department of Education. I don't think it's because people are ill-willed or anything, but I think it's because things take, you know, longer than they should sometimes. I think we do, if there would be one or two things that I would ask, is that this committee at an appropriate time have a review of the new law in terms of the implementation of the law and how it's gone, because there have been a number of glitches, and we do have some legislative proposals to tweak some of the systems in here. And then I guess one of the concerns I do have was an admission by the department just about a month ago that some of the student records and transcripts and documents were released to people, which is a violation of federal privacy laws, state privacy laws. Some of those students, my understanding is, were also special ed kids, so it's a violation of IDEA laws. And I think there needs to be an investigation by the legislature of how those things are handled when there is a violation of these kinds of laws. So those would be my only comments.
Okay, thank you. Is someone else here that asked to be heard? Kara Campbell?
Hello, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee. I sincerely apologize for interrupting inappropriately.
Say your name. And
my name is Kira Campbell. Mm-hmm. I've been a teacher for 15 years. I was teaching at Blue Sky for two of those 15 years. Before that, I was a teacher for 13 years. Before I came to Blue Sky, I was a teacher in good standing at another district. And the reason I went to Blue Sky, because I was told that the students there were at risk, and I have a heart for at-risk kids. When I was at the previous school, I worked in an alternative setting, so specifically at-risk kids, for 7 years. So I'm very experienced with working with this group of kids. I was astonished at what I found at Blue Sky when I was working there. I was harassed by counselors to pass students when they did not deserve to be passed. I found that students were giving classes like History of Rock and Roll instead of the state-mandated class like U.S. History, or they were given Psychology instead of U.S. History. So it's not necessarily what is in the U.S. History curriculum that is the problem. The problem is students are being deliberately scheduled for classes that do not meet standards. This is happening according to the MDE audit at a rate of 90% in some cases. That is why there is such a big scrutiny held against this school. there's only a few students that are graduating with the requirements as mandated by the state. What Ms. Lavarado was said, yes, the curriculum was approved. I was one of the teachers that worked on the U.S. history curriculum, and it was approved by MDE. Unfortunately, again, the case was those kids weren't being given that class, so therefore they couldn't take it. Or even if the kids didn't pass it, they were still being allowed to graduate. What made me go forward, and again, I went to the school trying to correct and fix in-house. I went to my own social studies staff. I went to the administration. And when I knew they were not going to fix it, because I saw an email from one of the administrators saying, we are not going to follow the requirements set forth by the state because what we fear will happen is a big dropout rate. So then I have seen emails showing that when I made a report to the board to tell them what was happening, that they were going to try and get rid of me. And they did fire me within 6 months. And now what is happening is they are taking all their efforts and instead of trying to fix the problem and working diligently on correcting it, they are trying to say that everyone is against them. And that is not the case. There was one more thing I wanted to say, but I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Does anyone have any questions of Ms. Campbell? Mr. Noble.
Yeah, that's good. Madam Chair, I stayed to hear this because the Office of the Legislative Auditor has just this week opened an evaluation of online learning. It was unrelated to what you have heard. Therefore, I just wanted to make it clear to the members, as you become aware of the fact that this is one of the evaluations that we were asked to do, directed to do by the Legislative Audit Commission, and it has just now commenced. I'm hopeful that we will be able to work our way through it and issue a report to you on some of the issues that have been raised more generically about the standards, the role of the department, the delivery of curriculum through online learning. I don't know, frankly, the degree to which we would get directly into the issues that have been addressed to you today, given the potential for litigation and other kinds of things that might occur. We would try to avoid that, but I think that this case brings forth a number of issues that are going to be there even after this particular case might be resolved. So I just, again, wanted you to be aware that we are going to do an evaluation of how online learning is being delivered to K-12 students and what the role of the Department of Education is in regulating and overseeing it.
Thank you, Mr. Romo. I appreciate you'd identified this to me at the beginning of the meeting, and I'm appreciative that you were here and did take the time to listen as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I thought
Dr. Hanlon?
Yeah, I'd like to make one comment regarding Ms. Campbell. As you'll note in my opening statements, I said 2 years ago that was four directors before, an entirely new curriculum before. What Ms. Campbell, I believe, was saying is her experience at the school was 2 years ago. Since we've totally installed a new curriculum, as you see here, and we have different directors in place, we have different checks and balances in place, we have addressed that issue successfully, ma'am.
Thank you. Ms. Hermanson. And then we're going to wrap you up here.
Madam Chair,
thank you, members for being so patient.
And I appreciate your patience. I guess I just want to clarify a couple of things. First, the data breach occurred prior to this administration. We've attempted to close that, just for the record. What this process will do, we have the authorizer process. There is a contract between the authorizer and the school. The department's options are to go in and sever a contract. However, prior to that, the authorizer should be given the opportunity to do what you've put out in law, which is review their contract with their school. I've heard comments about hearings. When there is a hearing, a more formal hearing in this process, that when we follow each of the steps that are laid out, that someone is going to make a final determination on this, on the claims by both parties. And I'm not going to get into who's right and who's wrong, but we can work through what this is a legal process to find some determination. If we're wrong, we will find that out. If we're substantiated, we will find that out. And I guess what we would, and there's potential of litigation to follow even that. So I guess at this point, we want to take this process to its conclusion. There will be chances for people to lay out their concerns and claims. And I know they've asked you to do an independent investigation. Well, we hope that a lot of these issues will be laid out in a hearing down the road. If, in essence, the authorizer decides that they are going to continue or deny this contract with their school, and we hope to get some finality. We've heard about continuing investigation. We've completed our investigation at this point, and we don't really intend. Most of this documentation came in prior to this administration, and I can't answer as to the reason for all of it, but I think there was reasons for the request for information. And again, we're trying to close the circle on this process because, as you can see, it's creating issues for everybody. So.
May I ask one question, Ms. Hermanson? Has the staff at the level that are working on the review and investigation, have they changed with administration, or are they part of the classified employees that are carrying out these operations?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think, and I'll have to check on this, I think there was some independent staff, but also there's been the staff that have been in place have been in place in many cases throughout this, and so they are very familiar with the benchmarks and standards. In listening to the discussion from Blue Sky, part of this is a review of the transcripts. And for us to make a determination, there are many students there. We had to basically base it on when you finally graduated a student, are they meeting the graduation requirements? And that's why, in some instances, it's taken this long to reach that final determination. Because if they're still in the process, they can still meet the standards as they go through the curriculum. What we had to find out, our kids being graduated that are not meeting the standards, and our investigation indicated that they were.
Okay, thank you, Senator Hand.
Yes, Ms. Hermanson, I just, looking at this letter from to Brian Rossi from Ms. Montano, I don't understand what the point of the letter is. It's essentially saying that they want the authorizer to respond by March 21st, saying that they're going to terminate the contract with the school, or if they don't, that the department will. So, I mean, I'm confused by this process of saying, well, we're going to have the authorizer review what's going on and make a determination, but it's pretty clear what you're saying is to the authorizer, doesn't matter what you decide, you should terminate the contract. And if you don't, we will. So what's the point of having the authorizer involved in this if you've already made the determination to close the school?
Madam Chair, committee members, Senator Hand. We do respect the fact that the authorizer is engaged in a contract with the school. We reserve the right, or the commissioner reserves the right to express her authority. However, with respect to the existing contract, that is why we chose to pursue that option.
Oh, and
Senator Hand.
I guess, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not clear what the role of the authorizer is here. As it's outlined, what you're saying is to the authorizer, close the school by March 21st, and if you don't, we will.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, we have just asked them to respond. They may choose to do heard a little bit about an independent review of the issues, and if they bring to us evidence that we feel we're not closing the school on March 21st, we are asking them to bring back what they've done and give us the information. You know, we're fully capable of changing our minds should we be given some additional information. At this point, we haven't seen it, and we feel that we're also reserving our right to proceed absent anything that substantiates anything other than what we found in our investigation.
So, Ms. Hermanson, you're saying that it is kind of a directive that they have to notify whether they're either terminating or not renewing. So that's the choice.
Madam Chair.
Not correcting anything, or you feel that that aspect has been exhausted.
Madam Chair, if we find new information, we're always open to looking at it. But, we've been pretty thorough on our investigation, and we at this point have not seen the evidence that that these students graduated meeting all of the requirements under law.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience and for the folks that have been in attendance. I think this has been an educational experience for us in terms of the impacts of some of the laws and policies that we've taken. So thank you, members, for sticking it out here. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Have a good weekend. We'll see you next Monday, committee.